and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 32. And I'm your host, Chris Zellner, and this week we are discussing the week that was February 23rd through the 29th, 1992. And I'm joined this evening by my co-host, David Bixenspan. Bix, how are you doing?
I am doing fine. How are you?
Good, good. Trying not to get this sinus infection deal that's going around my house, so I'm trying to avoid it like the plague, because God knows I don't need to get sick.
If you don't catch it from people around you, you'll catch it from me over the internet.
Well, if diseases could be caught over the internet, there would be a lot of people in bad shape right about now. I'll tell you that for a fact. But anyway, we are... Oh, God, you know, look at all the reprobates that are online, you know, that people talk to. I mean, really, come on. I mean, seriously. But anyway, or watching porn, for that matter. You get all kind of crazy diseases from that. Watching the sunny porn will give you a lot of social diseases. But anyway, we're joined this evening by a special guest, a man who, wrestling historian, has worked in the ring, been a sheet reader for years, also a podcast host himself, as he's a co-host of the Indie Riffic podcast on the MLW podcast network. We have Matt Farmer with us tonight. Matt, how you doing?
Man, I'm doing good, and I love the segue of talking about STDs and diseases before you bring me on the air.
Well, it's wrestling.
It's not fitting, but, you know.
Well, you have to consider what territory you grew up on.
Exactly, yes.
Ooh, yes, yes. There are a lot of nice, reputable people that worked in the Pacific Northwest over the years. But I love the territory.
And there still is.
Yeah, I love that territory to death. But, yeah, it was like Memphis in many, many ways. But on that note, we're going to go to 1992, and of course we ended last week with WCW, so we start this week with WCW, and
we should remind everyone, though, why we picked this week.
Because that's right, yeah. This is a leap year, so Super Brawl 2 took place on leap day, February 29th, on a Saturday pay-per-view. So maybe they did that for that reason in particular. I don't know. But, yep, Super Bowl II took place on February 29th in Milwaukee. And they said that a lot of people expected this to be the show of the year. Well, it was a virtual consensus that this was a good show. Somehow expectations were so high that it didn't quite live up to the card of the year mark. Still, there were legitimate match of the year contenders on the show. And most of the matches were good. The main event in which Sting defeated Lex Luger to win the WCW Championship for a second time was a letdown for a pay-per-view main event, let alone a major world title change match. Preliminary figures we received as of Monday indicated a buy rate of around 0.6, which if it holds up nationally has to be a terrible disappointment. While legitimately some of this can be blamed on the increase in price from $19.95 to $24.95, one can blame a fall in purchases by almost half of Starrcade on that. Part of it has got to be attributed to the main event not garnering enough interest. Considering on paper this looked to be a great card, and with the debut of Jesse DeBody Ventura thrown in, it says there is still a long way to go. Being 1 month before WrestleMania, price of $29.95 could be attributed by some as a factor, but they've run pay-per-view shows 1 month before Mania every year and always have done decent business. If the 0.6 holds up, that would be around $2.35 million total gross. So, Bix, what do you think about the thing about the buy rate here, Dave's talking points about disappointment. I mean, WCW wasn't the hottest promotion in the world at this time.
No.
So, I mean, what are your opinion on that?
I don't think it's that big a surprise. I guess they were putting a lot of hope into Jesse helping them draw a big number, is the way I would kind of read that, since they made such a big deal out of his sign.
I can see that. But still, it's just an announcer.
Well, you tell them
that. You know?
Yeah. What's that?
I said, you tell them that if they...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it was a Saturday was a part of it, too. You know?
Well, I'm trying to think, though. Were pay-per-views pretty much always Sundays by this point, or did you still have a little more you know, I guess I don't know if irregularity would be the right word, but because I'm trying to think.
This one was Saturday.
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying how many non-Sunday pay-per-views did you have by that point? Because I'm thinking back, like, Royal Rumble 94 was a Saturday, as far as the big two. But I think most were on Sundays by this point.
Yes. I can't remember many off Sundays. You, Matt, do you remember any off Sundays around this era?
No, I don't. But you got to remember also that was just a preliminary figure. And at that time, those preliminary numbers were not, I mean, they were across the board at times. Because we see it actually when the final number did come out, it was actually a surprisingly healthy pay-per-view as far as buys go. Dave mentioned something about it being lower than Starrcade. And in fact, I think it did about 5,000 buys more than Starrcade. So,
well, there you go.
it turned out okay for the company.
Yeah, there you go. And that's a great point about the preliminary buy rates. We've seen this in UFC lately and other, you know, other things where, or in boxing, where people could have these, you know, big numbers and then it doesn't live up to that or it goes above expectations. So
it's
not an exact science.
I also think at the time that Dave, when he was projecting his preliminary buy rates, I think what he was doing was calling some of the local cable companies, because at the time it wasn't nationally recorded, or it wasn't, you wouldn't know until 3 months later. One cable system could have done surprisingly well, while one across the country did horrible. So I think he based a lot of his projections on a few of the cable companies that he had connections with, because the buy rate ended up being at like a 0.96, which is way above expectations. Or the preliminary buy rate. So, you know, in hindsight, it did a lot better than what they were projecting it to do.
Right. Whereas now, I think Dave's fairly open about the fact that a lot of his preliminary info comes from DirecTV.
Correct.
So because that's covering the whole country, even though DirecTV does skew a little more towards sports fans, it's because it's covering the whole country, it's going to give you a more accurate prediction than just a single cable company would have.
And that's what he has.
And in 1992, there were so many, remember, there were so many mom and pop cable companies, you know,
right.
There's a lot fewer today. So it would have been a lot harder, especially just days after a pay-per-view, to get an accurate estimate.
Yeah. Well, the live show from the Mecca in Milwaukee drew a full house of 5,000 fans, 4,000 paid, $467,000 house. The atmosphere for the show was about the level of most pay-per-views. There was a surprising amount of banners all over the building. The most were for Sting and for Jesse, who got a huge reaction live coming in on a Harley. Probably followed by the Steiners, although there were many also for Liger and for Pillman. Cactus Jack, Rick Rude, Paul E., and even a few for Terrence Taylor and Ric Flair, who wasn't there, of course. Dave wasn't sure if it was the time. The show lasted from 5:30 p.m. to 8:47 p.m. local time. But the crowd clearly got tired, and the heat wasn't what you would have expected for the so-called important matches. The decision to start the show off with a bang with Liger Pillman sounded smart on paper because they wanted to do a blowaway show, and especially start with a guaranteed blowaway match. However, this was such a blowaway match that it really wasn't until 5 minutes later that the crowd fully got into a match. The crowd seemed tired for Rude versus Steamboat, and while they reacted to Steam versus Luger, it was anticlimactic and really not a good match at all. As world title matches go, it would rank in the bottom tier. They didn't see nearly as many people knowing in the crowd this was Luger's last hurrah. The company, as one would think, for something that has been such a poorly kept secret. It was nothing like last year in St. Petersburg, and it was Sid Vicious's last match, and it seemed everyone knew about it. Yeah, I mean, Vicious, I remember the time, you know, Luger was never on television. So even to me, and I read the newsletters, he was never on television. Only in tape promos, and he shows us up for this match looking like he just put on 40 pounds of muscle. And he's like, wow, this dude is doing something different here. And it just was weird to me. I mean, I knew something was up. I mean, what, as a young kid at the time, what were you thinking?
I did not see the pay-per-view live. I don't remember when I first saw it, but I remember, I think it was the following Saturday morning or early Saturday afternoon, I'm listening to the one of the local wrestling radio shows was done by some guys at Adelphi University on their in-house college radio station. I'm trying to remember the name. Oh, it was Pistol Pete Schwann and Dave Piledriver Schwartz. And I don't remember the name of the show. I don't remember what the name of the show was, though. And I just remember one of them saying Lex Luger looked like he was going to explode. And I think that was the first time I ever heard that term used for someone in that condition.
Yeah. I mean, man, he was jacked to the bejesus.
Within 30 seconds, he's just dripping like a puddle, like a bucket of sweat, too. And Jesse even brings it up in commentary, too. It was so apparent. Like, if you got a back shot of Luger, it was just zits and sweat.
Not a good combination, I'll tell you that.
Oh.
Well, on to the show.
Well, and I didn't peek to see if it's later in our notes, but it was so bad that Kip Fry apologized because he was so obviously on steroids that as they were trying to institute a serious drug testing program, he had to apologize for Lex Luger obviously being on steroids.
It didn't happen because, you know, this is the last day of the week. So that happened afterwards. But yeah, that's right. He did have to apologize for Luger. I mean, really, when have you ever heard that?
Yeah,
the boss of Rhythm Rush having to apologize for one of his performers, and but not being drunk, just the way he looked physically. That's insane, totally insane. But anyway,
did TNA the show proper?
We had a dark match.
Yeah, they did.
I don't remember doing.
I don't think they apologized. Well, they gave the freebies to the people who bought the pay-per-view, but that they actually apologized for the quality of the match. They did not apologize for Jeff Hardy.
Oh, that's right.
If I remember correctly.
But yeah, but that's different. Like I said, that's under the influence of something. Lex Luger was just blowed up from steroids. Yeah. That's a big difference. So anyway, dark match. Big Josh, Matt Bourne, pinned Diamond Dallas Page in 7:38 with a butt drop off the top rope that his father, Tough Josh, Tough Tony Bourne, made famous in the 1960s in Oregon. Page's best spot was spinning into the crowd, 3/4 of a star. Yeah, this is the very early period of Diamond Dallas Page as a wrestler.
Yeah.
And Matt, you know, Northwest guy, Matt Bourne is Big Josh. I mean, what did you think about that whole deal?
You know, WCW at that time had so many wacky gimmicks. I didn't think it was that horrible. I was a big fan of Matt Bourne. And so, of course, the name bothered me. But the gimmick didn't really bother me because, I mean, he still wrestled. So it was fine with me. But, I mean, geez. The Diamond Dallas Cage gimmick was stupid at the time, too. So it was just par for the course with WCW.
Yeah. It's just, it came off like a WWF deal where they just take a guy who you've seen on television. Matt Bourne had been all over ESPN and USWA stuff, and he wanted to make him something completely different. That's insulting the wrestling fans, really.
Yeah, and he was a star in their own region, you know, pretty much the same promotion almost, you know, in a weird way, the same promotion that he's wrestling in now, WCW. If you follow, you know, it's Georgia, it's based in Atlanta, and Matt Bourne was a big star in Atlanta. So it's like, it's a slap in the face of wrestling fans. It's one of those things that they didn't need to do because it didn't make anybody any extra money.
No. Well, to the pay-per-view proper, Brian Pillman pinned Juicer Thunder Liger 16:58 to regain the WCW light heavyweight title. Pillman was legit working against doctor's orders because of a back injury, which you couldn't tell if you watched the match. There were so many hot moves in this match that you couldn't even remember them all. But you had dives out of the ring, hot moves in the ring, unique submissions, and near falls like crazy, popping the crowd like it was Japan. For the most part, the crowd cheered both men. There was a USA chant when Liger had Pillman in the figure four, but almost immediately Liger did a somersault splash off the top rope to the floor, which got the crowd chanting, "Jushin, Jushin." Dave sensed there was a soft percentage of the crowd that wanted to boo Liger going in, but couldn't. Anyway, describing it doesn't do it justice. If you didn't see it, get a videotape. Finish saw Liger miss a diving headbutt off the top rope, but Pillman pinned him with a Japanese rolling clutch hold. I love it. Liger handed Pillman the belt, and both guys hugged after the match to a huge ovation, and the crowd heavily cheered both men when they left the ring. 4¾ stars.
Okay, now...
Now, Biggs, you know, Day was there live. Yeah, yeah, he was there live.
Yeah. They were, yep.
But go ahead. What were you going to say?
It is rolling clutch, right? It's not rolling crotch.
Yes, it is rolling clutch. That's why I laughed when I said that. And it is rolling clutch.
Is that even the right name for that move, though?
I thought it's rolling... I thought the actual name in Japan is rolling prawn hold.
Japanese... Japanese it can be good. When I did Japanese results in the 2000s, it was Japanese leg roll clutch hold, a rolling leg clutch hold. Something like that. It was that, something off of that form.
Crotch hold.
It was a rolling clutch hold, basically. Not crotch hold, clutch. But this is also, you know, in all respect to Dave, this is, he called Liger Riger for, you know, the first couple of years of existence. So,
yeah.
You know, that's what it is. But Bix, this match was a hell of a damn match, you know. And Liger, you know, remember him from, you know, sitting in Atlanta, he was one of the rare Japanese wrestlers who got over with an American crowd, you know, by what he did in the ring. And they didn't want to boo him. I know in Atlanta they didn't. I don't know if you saw him in the... Did you see him in the Meadowlands when he went there?
Not live, but I saw the match later. I saw the handheld.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, this is a absolutely tremendous match. I mean, it's far and away the, at least televised, the best match of the original WCW light heavyweight division. I say televised because in a minute I'm going to ask you to compare this to the Omni match, since you were at the Omni match. But I'm trying to remember when I first saw the whole thing, though. But I mean, because I didn't see the pay-per-view live. I might not have seen this for a couple of years, but I mean, even a couple of years later, I was still blown away by it. And I did see the edited version that was on New Blood on the Block sooner, which was do you remember those $10 WCW half hour?
Yeah. Yes, I have one of them. I think it's the one with the red box.
There's New Blood on the Block, Deadly Venom, The Best of Sting, Ravishing Recruit Raw, and before that there was, what was it? Oh, I'm forgetting the name now. There were two of them. I forget what they were called, though. Anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, Liger, but Liger's tremendous here. And I think, I mean, kind of at the time was kind of treated like, oh, he's getting over because he has all these great moves. But Liger is one charismatic son of a gun.
He is.
Oh, yeah. Always has been.
Yeah. I mean, no. He's a great babyface. He's a great heel. So, I mean, that's part of it. I mean, that's something we should make sure we mention, that we should not downplay his... psychology and his body language. And I love the way some people put it, that it's like, even though he's wearing a mask and a full bodysuit, Liger still has some of the best facial expressions in the history of wrestling.
Exactly. Yeah. Liger's one of those guys that even with an entire bodysuit on, you still could get the emotions from him. And very few guys could do that under a mask.
And a mask that doesn't even show his mouth, nothing. A mask that does not show any of his face.
No. One question, during this time frame, were you guys watching Japanese wrestling on a consistent basis?
I was not yet. Chris, you were.
Yeah.
Now, how did you compare this match with some of Liger's matches in Japan?
They were on par. I mean, the closest matches really you compare it to was Asano matches from 90. At this time and period. And, I mean, they're right there with him, I think. I mean, Pillman was just so great as a worker that's what, you know, put him up there. I mean, it wasn't a one-man show. Pillman more than held his own.
It wasn't. I remember at the time, because at the time I was getting weekly Japanese television, and both me and my friend at the time thought, and we were in wrestling training at the time, so we were experts, you know. We both thought that Pillman was like a notch below Liger, where we didn't get that with a lot of his Japanese matches. And I don't know, maybe if I rewatch it today, I would feel differently. But at the time, we felt that Liger, or that Pillman, was out of position a lot, and kind of awkward in spots.
Well, it's different. I mean, yeah, they have worked together in a few matches before. But it could have been Pillman's back issue too, but it still was a hell of a damn match.
It was, yes.
No matter how you look at it.
One thing I always thought was a hell of a damn match. Yeah. One thing I always thought was funny about this match, and it's not the only match between these two where it happens. Liger throws Pillman over the top rope and they completely ignore it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was like a recurring spot.
Yeah, there is some psychology issues.
Because didn't that happen in their match on the first Nitro too?
Yes.
And it didn't stop being DQ in WCW till 99, I think.
Yeah, way late.
So I always thought that was a little weird that they just kept doing that spot and that I don't blame, you know, Jim Ross and Jesse Ventura for ignoring it, because what can you do? But obviously the referees in WCW were not told to call it as a shoot. But I always thought it's one thing that Liger did it, but I always thought it was weird that they kept doing it.
Yeah, you would think they would address it, or at least Pillman would have addressed it. Say, hey, you know, pulled him aside and say, hey, you know, here, it's a DQ.
I guess Liger's like Vince. He really hates that rule.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. So, Chris, how would you compare this match to the Atlanta match?
The Atlanta match, of course, is better in my opinion, having seen it like I did. So, I would say that. But the this match was, it was great. I mean, it was a great match. I mean, there's not a whole lot of differences. I think the Omni match was a little bit longer, but. Yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of real differences to it. You know,
Super Bowl Super Bowl has a better finish.
Yes, that is the truth. That gives it a little bit more, to compare it against it. Yeah, that had a better finish, that's for sure.
Now, I'm trying to
remember. Both awesome.
Did they have a match in Japan, like, while Liger was champion, or am I getting that wrong? I don't think...
They did have a match in Japan where both titles were on the line.
But it might have been later.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
I'm trying to remember the time frame. I believe it was during Liger's reign as champion.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I can't remember when it was exactly. Yeah. But anyway, still an outstanding match. Second match on the show. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and Liger stayed over in WCW. I mean, he wasn't at the level of Muda, but when he'd come back, he was over.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't come back a whole lot, though. I mean, he came back some in this year and then didn't come back to win, 95?
Yeah.
Because he never came in 93, 94, so yeah, 95. So.
I remember during this time, Liger worked a lot of really odd house show matches too, where he would be in interesting tag team matches and things like that. Wasn't there one where he like wrestled or he teamed with Muda
against... I think it was Liger and Sasaki against Steamboat and Douglas, I think.
Yes, that sounds right.
In Philly, I think. I've never seen it though.
Yeah.
I remember hearing it was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right. I know of course, the famous one is the, Battle Bowl team with Bill Kazmaier.
Against that's Doc, like the most... and who was it?
No, 91 Battle Bowl.
Oh, against Mike Graham and...
Yeah.
Who was it? Who was Mike Graham's
name?
Where Mike Graham just decided to not catch Liger and then bragged about it years later.
Was it Firebreaker Chip?
Yeah.
Fellow and wrestling alumnus.
Yeah, and Pillman and Liger were in the NWA World Tag Title Tournament.
Actually, three Stampede alumni in that battle in that first Battle Bowl match. Kazmaier.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And then Doc half shooting on him when they wrestled in the 92 Battle Bowl.
Yeah.
Well, that was interesting because it's All Japan versus New Japan.
Yeah.
One of those rare matches. Okay. We have Steamboat and Douglas against Liger, Sasaki in Jacksonville on Christmas Day, then them in St. Petersburg on the 26th, Charlotte on the 27th, then Starcade. How about this on the 27th, too? Greenville, South Carolina, Sting defeated Jushin Liger.
Yeah, that was one of the matches I was thinking about because I saw a picture in a magazine or something, or I read a result, and I was like, man, that would be a really interesting match.
Then Philly on the 29th of December. So there you go, Bits. That did happen. Hmm. In front of 1,000 fans at the Civic Center. Hmm. Yikes. Okay, back to Super Bowl. The second match, Marcus Alexander Bagwell and Terrence Taylor in 736. Taylor was wearing a Ted DiBiase hand-me-down outfit, and Dave should get a pity these guys because there was no way to follow the previous match. Taylor carried Bagwell completely. Okay. And then, all right, before I read this,
this is
1992. So, okay, you got to put yourself in that mindset when you hear what Dave says here. Bagwell looked really gay, if that's the correct adjective, in that white outfit that was three sizes too small, which is why the crowd booed him. Bagwell got lost going into the rolling reverse cradle, and the pin was heavily booed, and the place cheered when Taylor hit him with a five arm after the match. 1.5 stars. Again, you got to remember what the area you're in. And all honesty, believe me, a lot of people thought Bagwell was gay in that era. So yes. It was what it was. But Matt, they were really pushing Bagwell hard. Yes. He wasn't ready yet. He had potential, but he wasn't ready yet. And a crowd of Milwaukee, I mean, this isn't the South. They were going to get behind Bagwell here.
No, and you also put him in a match that's in a position where neither guy is really going to get over. They're not in any plans really to get over. It's just a match, and whoever booked the card booked it as a throwaway match, obviously. They gave him 7 minutes, nothing great. So it was what it was. It's just a match. It's actually the kind of match that you want to book after a hot match so you could settle the crowd down a little bit. At least for a live crowd. Maybe not for pay-per-view, but for like a live house show, that's a good booking.
And also, to be fair...
They still do it today, though. WWE does it all the time.
And also, yeah. These two were in a really good tag match at the Clash the month before.
Yeah. And Biggs, what do you think about Terry Taylor's Million Dollar Man ripoff gimmick here?
I can't believe he didn't have a Virgil.
I know. It was Terry Taylor? I mean, come on. I mean, that's natural.
Yeah.
How he feels about
those kind of gimmicks, of course, just made WCW look second rate, which is something that they battled with their entire existence, you know. And it was just something, if you had friends over watching, they would say, oh, look at that poor man's Ted DiBiase.
Well, yeah.
And it's not that he did the gimmick, which was barely there anyway. It's that they gave him the you know, the fake tuxedo.
The suit.
Yeah.
Yeah, the suit. Yeah. The suit's what did it more than anything else. I mean, he could be the tailor-made man. He could be out there just dressed up in, like, suits and stuff. Yeah. Not. I mean, real suits, not the Teddy Biasi tribute gimmick
so
suit.
So his gimmick should have been that he was Terry Taylor.
Yes.
Yes.
Like, yeah, mild manner, 1985 Terry Taylor always wore suits.
They should have did what WWE did and call him the terrific Terry Taylor.
Terrific Terry. Yes. Yeah.
He was doing that gimmick for a while.
Yeah, that was later in the year.
Yeah, later in the year.
All right. Yeah, Ron Simmons, after a match, pinned Cactus Jack with a cross body block up the top rope, turned into a power slam in 6:33. Cactus took a few frightening bumps, the first one being hanging himself in the ropes. He also did an elbow drop off the middle rope to the floor. And after the match, Abdullah the Butcher did a run in, apparently to attack Jack. But lo and behold, he attacked Simmons instead. And they doubled on Simmons until the junk food dog came out of the audience and headbutted a few security guards, who, of course, doubled as television jobbers, and made the save. You'd be shocked at the pop JFD got with the fans chanting his name. He's dropped 61 pounds, although when the starting point is 346 pounds, that means there's still about 15 to 20 left to go. 2.5 stars.
Hey, wait a second.
Now, go ahead.
JYD was not bad during his brief WCW run around this time.
No, he, like I said, he dropped that weight and he got better. I mean, he moved around better. It definitely helped. And one thing about JYD, we got to say here, is he was always over.
Yeah.
Especially when he made his returns. You know, maybe, you know, once he got stayed around for a while and maybe fans would get tired of him. But every time he would make a return, the fans were hot for him. He had that white tux going on here with the blue jeans. quite the look. But I enjoyed this and the deal with Ron and JYD. I thought they were a pretty cool tag team.
Yeah, and they also.
But it was funny. It's funny though. It is funny though, because you know they had been a tag team 3 years earlier, and Ron turned on him.
Yeah.
And they did.
Go ahead, Vince. What were you gonna say?
And also, I like the thing they did later on with JYD and Mr. Hughes. I guess that was under Watts, but I thought that was kind of a creative idea where it was like a house show match where JYD. Was it that JYD headbutted Hughes, or that like Hughes's partner accidentally hit him and the glasses got smashed, and JYD, because he's a babyface, tried to make sure that Mr. Hughes didn't lose his eye, and then Mr. Hughes turned babyface and they teamed together as the cat and the dog.
I vaguely remember that.
Yes.
I thought that was kind of a clever thing. I don't know.
Yeah, big cat.
Not
that part, but the Curtis Hughes babyface turn.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. He was a big cat. The big cat Curtis Hughes. So that's why the cat and the dog.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead, Matt.
Oh, I was just saying this match. I mean, for its placement on the card, the little angle that they ran, that's perfect for a third match on the card. And JYD, man, the guy, like you said, he was over. I liked him, even though he couldn't work. I always liked him. He was simple, did what he knew how to get over, was over. And it was just something, you know, this is the kind of match that you'd want to book after a match like Pillman and Liger, because it's completely different.
Now, is this the match where Cactus tore his abdominal muscle, or am I thinking of a different one?
I think you're thinking of a different one. But this JYD at this point.
It was a clash.
Yeah, JYD was kind of like Jimmy Valiant in this era, you know, that type of guy to have on the show. You know, always over, you know, not going to do a lot, but, you know, always going to be over. So you got to have people like that.
Yeah, he just needs to do his headbutt and, you know, get on all fours and chase guys around. And that's what he's there for, you know.
Now, this match here, the fourth match, Tom Zink and Van Hammer beat Vinny Vegas and Richard Morton. That's right. Kevin Nash and Ricky Morton were once a tag team, which is funny. If you listen to Shoot interviews, Ricky Morton's done over the years talking about Kevin Nash. In 12 minutes, when Zink pinned Morton with a sunset flip coming out of the corner. Zink was subbing for Johnny B. Badd, who we'll talk about later why he wasn't on this show. And Morton replaced Mr. Hughes with the cover, reason being that it would make a better match. But actually, Hughes was pulled from the show as punishment for some kind of non-drug-related misdeed. It should have been okay with Zink and Morton doing all the work and just letting the green boys in for quick power spots. Instead, Hammer and Vegas worked most of the match. At times, it was surprisingly okay, but most of the time, that wasn't the case. There were a few botched up spots, and the brawling back and forth was terrible. After the match, Zink and Vegas yelled at each other, and it seemed like Zink was issuing a challenge. Dave just hoped it was for a one-on-one basketball game rather than a wrestling match. Negative half a star. But Matt, that's quite the substitutions here, putting Zink and Morton in this match. But yeah, Richard Morton, was that
for the better, or was it not for the better? I mean, I couldn't imagine that match being any better with Johnny B. Badd and Mr. Hughes in it.
It had better guys, but they didn't work the match. They hardly worked in the match. But what were your thoughts about heel Ricky Morton in this time period?
Ah, man, it was. It never got over. I don't know. To me, it was the whole gimmick where they were trying to do the Richard Morton and the Terrence Taylor. It just felt low class to me. Kind of like, I don't know, second rate maybe. Like they weren't really. I don't know. It's hard to say. I've always been a big fan of Ricky Morton, but as that gimmick, it just lost something for me. I know the deal they were going with.
I think, you know, they were trying to get these Southern guys, you know, these Southern name wrestlers, and trying to, you know, make them Northern or corporate, that was a way to try to get heat on him. And it, I mean, it worked, but it didn't work to what you would want it to work. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it worked by turning people away from him. It didn't help him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's one of those things that if somebody was a fan of Ricky Morton, it wouldn't have got heat with him. They just would have stopped watching him.
See, also, yeah. Taking the Southern boys and moving them to Wyoming.
Yes.
And
Mr. Hughes, the infraction that he committed was probably falling asleep in the ring.
That's right.
Well, then that's probably why Dave said non-drug related, because most of the time you would think that would be drug related, but Mr. Hughes has epilepsy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He probably just fell asleep during a match.
Yeah, poor Mr. Hughes. Great Indy trainer, though. We can't say that enough. Every time we talk about him on this show, maybe one of the best independent wrestling trainers in the business right now. Mr. Hughes, WWE 4.
Yep, and his school is in a wonderful part of Atlanta.
Yes. But Bix, Vinny Vegas, I always dug the Vinny Vegas gimmick. I thought Kevin Nash was funny in that deal. Why didn't you think that they went more with that?
In terms of a bigger push? I mean,
trying to spotlight him a little bit more.
Well, remember, WCW was all about pushing those guys depending on their contract.
Well, yeah, that's true,
they,
too. But
they were really, you know, that was something that they, you know, if you had a low contract, you just were not going to get a push, no matter how good you were. You know, it's just something that they wouldn't do.
And he was, I mean, he was still really green. He was a...
That's true.
He was just kind of...
But he was funny.
He was funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he had done Ross... He had done Ross's show like the week or two before this. He was going in and out of character, as I remember listening to it. And it was hilarious. I mean, this is what the first time I ever knew about, you know, Kevin Nash being the funny guy. I mean, he was just hilarious on that show.
When did they do that babyface turn tease when him and Dallas Page were teaming? Because didn't they who did they wrestle that they did a heel versus heel match and they were booked as the babyfaces? Was it
Jesus.
Was it? Yeah, that's
yes. Yes, it was that era. Yeah, it was in that era, yeah.
So it almost seemed like they were going to do something with him then, but, I mean, he was out the door not long after that.
It was in December 92, yeah. They did the house show matches around the loop. Yeah, and they worked, they did TV tapings, yeah. So, yeah, that would have been around that time period, December 92. Yeah. But, of course, Kevin Nash got tired of it and went to WWF.
Well, and also good luck trying to get Tex as the heel of Center Stage.
Oh, yeah, as you may remember from the Scott Hudson, Steve Prazak episode of Exile on Bad Street, there was no way Tex and Shanghai were going to be heels in that feud, that's for sure. But moving on to our next match, and now is where we get to the meat of the show. Yeah. Barry Windham and Dustin Rhodes beat Larry Zbyszko and stunning Steve Austin in 1821. This was a tremendous match. With good brawling back and forth. Austin's timing is just incredible considering his experience. They got heat on Windham in the early portion, then heat on Rhodes later. Windham made the hot tag and came in, went for the superplex, but Zbyszko shoved them off. Rhodes shoved Zbyszko off the top rope, and Windham pinned him with a flying lariat, 3¾ stars. Now, Big said, yeah, this is the era of where you could have plugged in anybody against a dangerous alliance, anybody in the babyface side, your top tier babyfaces, and you're going to have matches like this, whether it be television, pay-per-views. I mean, this was a great era of the tag team scene. Six-mans, regular tags, eight-man tags. Every television show was filled with them. This is great stuff.
And this is one of the better matches, too.
Yes.
I don't know if I'd go it that is, far, yeah. But I know some people who consider this like one of the five best WCW matches of the 90s, too.
Ooh, I've seen people really praise this match heavily, and I like the match a lot, too.
I
don't know if I'd go that high. Top 10, maybe, cusp. Definitely top 20. I can see top 20 argument, no doubt.
It's a very good match.
Yes.
It was, and yes.
Dustin and Barry, such a great tag team.
Yeah,
nobody talks about.
No, very underrated tag team. A lot of people think that Barry's career as far as an in-ring performer really dropped off like in 89, but this run in 92, he was excellent. He
Fantastic.
Really was.
Well, I guess what it is, though, is that he kind of... It took him some time to get back to where he was.
Yeah.
Because, I mean...
It started in 91, and with him and Arn... started teaming up, that's when he started finding his groove.
Yeah, and then
he got back
and then the babyface turn, and then it kept building and building, and when he started teaming with Dustin is when he was had fully regained his form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it carried on throughout the year, and then going into 93, I mean, he was fantastic as a worker. But and Zbyszko's another guy that doesn't get talked about enough. He blew out his name. Zbyszko in this era was really great. In his role as the cruncher.
He held his own
in that group.
Yeah. In the ring, I think this was Zbyszko's best period of time for his entire career.
Except maybe
when he was working with Bruno, but that's just because of the box office success. But I think in the ring, this was his best period of time.
Absolutely. And you look at that group of workers, Eaton, Rude, Anderson, Austin. I mean, Zbyszko more than held his own in that group. And it's a shame that he, left the group as soon as he did. Later on down the line.
Well, and I'll even say, if you want to put one of the tag matches from that era up there, it's maybe one of the very best WCW matches of the 90s. It's not Dangerous Alliance yet, but it's the same group of guys. Him and Arn against Steamboat and Dustin from The Clash is
probably
the best WCW tag match of the 90s.
Of course, yeah. And we talked about on Between the Sheets. Yeah, that's... Hell of a match.
What's really interesting is when I go back and watch the WCW from 92, I actually enjoy it a lot more now than I did at the time. At the time, for some reason, I realized they were having good matches, but it felt at times just kind of, I don't know, mundane maybe. Maybe it's because there was so much new talent in there that it felt, I don't know, it just had a different feel to it.
I have an idea why. Because when Watts came in, at least, Watts stripped the shows of all the production values.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this era is at its best.
Right. Yeah, I really liked that era, though, when Watts came in and did those things. I liked it personally as a fan because I was like a hardcore fan,
Well, and every television show had meant something in its era. Pro had a main event type match. Main Event Man had a main event match, at least one. Power Hour. Every show worldwide, every show had main event caliber matches on the shows. And in some areas, you didn't get that in WCW.
I mean, this is probably the last time that Worldwide was, if not had parity with Saturday Night, was just below it. This is probably 92-93 is probably the end of that.
Yeah.
And before they moved to Disney.
Yeah.
I remember recording those shows every week and really enjoying it. In fact, I remember making like comp tapes of those shows because there were so many good matches that were taking place.
I did the same thing, but my stupid ass taped over them. So I was a complete moron in that era at 12 years of age. But I used to do that same thing too. I had all kind of good stuff. Yeah. Anyway, moving on to another tag match that was pretty awesome on this show. Bobby Eaton and Arn Anderson retained the WCW World Tag Titles, beating Rick and Scott Steiner by DQ with the dreaded Dusty finish in 20 minutes. They announced that Paulie Dangerously was banned from ringside during this match, which gave him some time to make a costume change. Eaton and Anderson sold the Steiner's big moves for the first half of the match, which consisted of power moves and slowdown tactics in between. There were a lot of good moves with slow pace and spots, and the consistency of crowd intensity wasn't what you'd expect. Rick came off the top rope to a knee in the groin. They started working on Rick, but you didn't get the sense a lot of sympathy. Scott came in, but was cut off and thrown over the top rope behind the ref's back. Rick made the hot tag. They went to the finish. Arn threw white powder in a bag into Rick's eyes. And since he couldn't see, he gave Randy Anderson a belly-to-belly suplex. Scott gave Bobby a Frankenstein and got a three count when the second ref came in. Finally, head referee Nick Patrick came in and reversed the decision because Rick gave the ref a suplex. That finish wouldn't have been so bad. They hadn't done so many house shows, like almost every one over the past 2 months, 3.25 stars.
What would have made that finish better is if Scott got powdered, gave the Frankensteiner to Randy Anderson.
I don't know if he could have took it.
I know.
Nate Patrick would probably been the only one that would have took it since he had been a worker. But
well, Randy Anderson had been a worker.
Yeah, he had worked a bit, but. And he was small enough that Scott probably could have did it to him.
Oh man, that could have been disastrous. But yeah, this feud was fun. Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. Great tag match.
I remember the pro Chicago version of WCW Pro, when they aired, they would air like extended highlights of their matches from the USC Pavilion. And I was like, man, this looks really good, you know? And then of course this match was out, and the feud didn't last very long, but man, I mean, it was really good stuff. And Arn Anderson and Bobby Eaton, what can you say about their prowess as tag wrestlers? And then of course the Steiners were probably the best tag team in wrestling in this time period. So yeah, I mean, there's no way really you could have a bad match between these guys, I would think, Bix.
Yeah, although I always felt kind of underwhelmed by your Steiners against traditional great heel tag teams type matches like this, or even the matches with the Midnights. But it always felt like the Steiners against someone other than like a fellow power high spot team didn't quite work as well as you'd hope.
Yeah, I agree.
I can understand that. The Steiners' best matches were like against the Nasty Boys, Vader and Hughes. They had really great match with them. You know, stuff like Doom.
I think one of the issues may have been is that the fans, you know, they're talking about how the crowd intensity wasn't into it. I think a lot of the fans didn't believe that Bobby Eaton and Arn Anderson could beat up the Steiners.
Well, I was going to say that you can't really get heat on the Steiners.
Yeah, that's the
problem.
And
this is Milwaukee, you know, and this is not the South, it's Milwaukee.
Yeah.
So different dynamic problem.
And to be fair, Eaton and Anderson weren't always protected as well as they should have. You know, they were sometimes treated like second-class wrestlers.
Or in this era, though. They were, in this era, you know, treated better.
Yeah, they were, but that stink sometimes takes a long time to get off, you know?
Yeah. Well, Arn had it. But yeah. I guess Eaton definitely was, you know, in the mid-card for a lot of 91.
Yeah. And Eaton had that tremendous run in early, you know, 91 also, but he was also at times doing jobs. You know, he just wasn't treated as well. So
yeah.
I don't think the fans believe that Eaton in 1992 was a match for the Steiners.
Well, the Eaton TV title loss to Austin, even though it was a screw job finish on him, he just still came out of it looking terrible. Because it was treated as such an afterthought that he lost the title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, moving on. United States heavyweight title match. Ravishing Rick Rude pinned Ricky the Dragon Steamboat in 20 minutes and 1 second to retain the title. Before the match, there are several interview segments with Missy Hyatt that appear to be done live or actually filmed the week earlier in Rock Hill, South Carolina,
okay,
where the ninja, quote-unquote, chased Medusa away, which one is supposed to figure led to Daniel Cigar adorn a ninja costume and come to the ring with Steamboat. This was a 70s-style match. All the spots were perfect, and there were some nice moves thrown in, but kind of a slow pace since they were going 20. Steamboat really turned it on in the end, with a finish coming when Paul Lee, the ninja, hit Steamboat twice with a foam, and Rude pinned him 2 3/4 stars.
Now, I have a question for Matt, though, before we move
on. Go ahead.
Yeah. One of the stories behind the show is that there were people who politicked to get this match the best match bonus and not Pillman Liger. Do you have
which we'll talk
idea
about
who,
later.
Well, yeah, do you have any idea who it was?
That did the politicking?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Okay, I figured you might, so I was curious, but I have no idea either.
No, I can't remember if I did know. No.
Now, after the match, the ninja was revealed. And it was quite the revealing, wasn't it, Bix?
Yes, it was.
Okay, Jim, you're right. A heartbreaking loss. And Jim said it had to be Paul Lee. Now, of course, what do you think about this situation?
Let me say this, okay? A man who I respect very much told me one time that a snake is most deadly when you think it's dead. And I think Paulie...
Eric.
We don't know. We don't know. We didn't see the ninja with his mask off or anything. We're not so sure what's going on. One thing we do know, Eric,
is that Missy Hyatt is back in the dressing room area. Maybe she can answer some questions. Missy, it's all yours, lady.
Lady.
So much controversy surrounding the U.S. title match, and Rick Rude is still the champion. I don't know what happened to the ninja. It's just like he went crazy or something. But let's try to get an interview with the champion, Rick Rude. And here's his dressing room. And I'm like, oh, my God! Oh, my!
It was Dangerous Lines with Paul.
Yeah, there you go. It was in a ninja outfit.
It was a ninja outfit.
Just as we suspected, Paulie Dangerously was under that ninja costume.
I'll give you credit, Jim Ross. You were right. You were brilliant. But so was Paulie, wasn't he?
Well, his plan certainly worked. There's no doubt about it. And I hope that Steamboat will get the opportunity to wrestle Rick Rude again for the U.S. title. But right now, we've come to the point. And
all right. And one thing we got to note about this show as well, Ross and Ventura working together. Not the smoothest of rides on this show, was it?
I always liked them together, though.
I know, it was funny, but they didn't like working together. That's always a funny deal. But
I could see why they wouldn't like working with each other, though, because they're kind of similar in a lot of ways, except they're on different spectrums. You know, I mean, Ventura, they're really both boisterous and. I don't know. Jesse would be a hard guy to work with at times as your color guy. Because he's so argumentative when you're doing color, which isn't always necessarily, you know, it doesn't always make for a great combination.
Well, Jim always was good with the stooging heels like Paul and Cornette and Lawler and Michael Hayes and stuff like that. You know, Jesse was your, you know, this strong heel voice. That sometimes would be like a middle of the road guy too. You know, he wouldn't always straddle that heel side. But
and those guys that you mentioned would set Ross up, where Jesse wouldn't set him up because he wanted to look strong. You know what I mean? He wanted to protect his character and his gimmick. So well,
and that's where Tony was better with Jesse.
Yeah. Both in WWF and WCW.
Of course.
Correct. Yeah.
Well, and Tony would even set up. I mean, Tony would even set up Jesse, or at least it seemed that way. You know, the most quoted Jesse line now these days it seems like it's the one from SummerSlam '89, where was it? Warrior hits Rude with a chair outside the ring, and Tony says it's legal because they're outside the ring. So, and then of course Jesse says, "So what? So are you saying that if he took a gun and shot him, it would be legal because it's outside the ring?"
Still, my favorite Tony Jesse combo is the Fall Brawl '93, where they legitimately had to turn the mics off at one point during one of the matches because they're both laughing so hard at each other. And I cannot remember what match it was, but they had to turn the mics off. You get dead air for a few minutes because they can't quit laughing, and they're at ringside. You can see them on camera. Laughing.
That's two shows
hilarious.
In a row. Because wasn't there? Didn't they catch them on camera laughing a few times at the Clash? I mean, on mic.
Yeah.
When was? Because I think they're laughing along with Flair and everyone else during the Shockmaster thing. Now, when was the Arn Anderson Eric Watts angle Clash? Was that Clash or a different one?
That was a different one.
But still, we're talking several major shows in 93, because you remember what I'm talking about, where they do the angle where Watts gets arrested, and they're showing it.
Yeah.
I don't know if they showed it on a screen or whatever, but then the Daddy's Boy chant starts up for Watts, and you can hear Ventura just completely losing it.
Yeah.
That's right, yes. I do remember.
Yeah, I think the match that they were laughing was the Nasties against Anderson and Roma. At that Fall Brawl show. I can't remember exactly. I haven't watched it in years. But that was, I mean, they just lost it. But anyway, real quick before we move on to the next match. I mean, what did you think about that Heyman angle as the ninja?
I mean, it's fun. I mean, it's predictable.
Cute.
But fun, yeah. And it makes Steamboat.
Cutesy.
The problem is it makes Steamboat look like an idiot. Especially because it's not like we ever knew who the ninja was anyway.
Yeah.
It's just a guy, so it's always like that. He didn't have any kind of personality. He was just a guy who was there and didn't really do anything. So it always telegraphed it too much. I think that Paulie, that it was going to end up being Paulie or Paulie replacing the Ninja or whatever.
Yeah. All right, moving on to our main event. Sting beat Luger for the title at 1301. Luger was so huge, he looked like a member of a different species. If it hadn't been confirmed already, this officially confirmed Luger's joining the WBF. They spent the first 2 minutes pretending they were doing a silent movie by standing there and doing nothing. Then they started working.
That's not how a silent movie works.
Then they started working, and the near 300-pound Luger blew it within 2 minutes. The match was kept simple, and it did have interest, but it was a long way from a classic title change. Luger controlled the match, pretty much playing Superman, even though Sting was Stinger Splash. Sting did get Luger in a torture rack and kicked out of his pile driver. Finish came out of nowhere with Sting decking Harley Race and pinned Luger with a crossbody block. Luger and Sting shook hands and embraced as a match, but on television, they switched to a crowd shot, so the folks at home didn't see it. Star and a half. How about that, huh?
Too bad we didn't have a handheld of them hugging in the ring.
It'd been like the click curtain call.
Exactly. It would have been
the
curtain call.
The dudes with attitudes curtain call. The Steiners should have come out. JYD should have came out. And they could have had the dudes with attitudes curtain call in the ring.
Oh, man, that would have been awesome.
Meanwhile, at a bowling alley somewhere in the southeast, Paul Orndorff watches with a single tear in his eye.
Hey, he was working Smoky Mountain this time, so he would have been in Knoxville.
And Doug Furness.
Yeah.
Wait, was Doug Furness one of the dudes with attitude?
He was like an unofficial member.
Yeah. Remember they did that six-man tag match? And
yeah, he was affiliated.
Yeah. So was Elegante.
Elegante, that's right, yeah. But this match was a total disappointment, though.
You know the move? The move of this match is actually when Harley Race took a backdrop on the floor.
Oh, yeah. Harley did that a lot in this era.
He'd do a run it, like the referee would get distracted and he'd come in and try to do the headbutt off the second rope and he'd miss.
<No. Yep. laughs> Harley worked as hard as a manager and some of his guys.
Isn't this after the boat? When was the boat accident?
I think it was after this.
93? Okay.
Yeah.
But still, old.
You see so much of Flair in Harley Race, or you see so much of Harley in Flair, or vice versa.
Oh, it's Flair and Harley. Harley's one of Flair's idols.
Exactly. I mean, those guys, you know, if Flair was able to do those things today, or if he was allowed to, he would be
doing allowed. Oh, believe me, he would want to so bad. If you don't think that he would let Sasha Banks press slam off top rope, he would do it in a second.
He would be taking backdrop. He would take a backdrop on the floor every night of the week if you allowed him right now.
Well, remember there was a period when he was working regularly, like in like when was it like 2003, like early Evolution, where he started taking that bump in every single match.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. He would still do it, just like Harley would, you know.
Now with this match, though, I actually do kind of like the finish. Just that it stings to
do
something different to win, but it's still not—it's not completely different because it's still sort of because it's a splash and he has the Singer Splash and that whole thing. So I actually kind of like the finish.
I did too. I liked it.
It just the match was a disappointment considering all the build up and stuff, but it also goes to show that the main match that never got done on WCW pay-per-view was Sting versus Rick Rude, and yeah, that would come later, you know. Sting, of course, was a world champion. I mean, and what happened after the show, which I guess we'll go ahead and get into, after the card in the ballroom at the Mecca, they did a work press conference with Sting, and it was interrupted by Dangerously and Rude. Rude threw a drink in Sting's face, and the entire Dangerous Alliance attacked Sting until Nikita Koloff made the save for his face turn. Now, this angle aired on television the next Saturday. One of Rude's blows, they thought it was Rude anyway, potatoed Sting's eye, which was badly swollen the next day in Chicago. Gee, Rick Rude hitting somebody hard? Come on. But this, you would have thought with this could have led to, you know, a big Sting Rude world title match on pay-per-view or something, but it never happened.
They didn't have any, I don't know if they worked each other on house shows, but as far as, you know, singles matches, I don't know if they had anything on TV until the Clash, and that was in the King of Cable tournament. That wasn't even a storyline match.
And then, of course, later on, you know, years later when they worked together, but This was quite the angle here, as we got Jesse the Body Ventura as your roving reporter.
Here we go.
Jesse the Body Ventura here at the post-match party for World Championship Wrestling, and we're hoping that the champion, the newly crowned champion Sting, will make an appearance here at the party. But for right now, let's talk to a few of the people and see just how they enjoyed WCW Super Brawl 2. I see Tony Schiavone over here. Maybe we can get Tony in here a little bit. Hi, Tony. Tony, you're oh, and here comes the champ now. Well,
I love that we're recording this.
Never mind, Tony.
Now we got plenty of reporters over here. I'm going to move over and try to get in on fielding some of these questions here. Follow me if you can with the camera.
Sting! Terrific match. Terrific match.
Thank you.
Really great.
Thank you, Mr. Fry.
Who's got the first question?
Okay. Where you want to defend your title? Is it worldwide? Are you planning to go to Japan?
Whatever comes up first. Nothing, of course, right now has been discussed or talked about or signed especially, but I will go to Japan. The great Muda, a lot of other great wrestlers over there I'd like to defend it against, as well as a lot here. So, yeah, Van Vader, there's a few. So,
I'd like to congratulate you on your second reign. How would you rate your opponent tonight as opposed to the Ric Flair who you won it against the first time in Baltimore?
The Ric Flair?
Obviously, he's a much bigger, more powerful wrestler.
I'll say.
The strongest I've ever been up against, as a matter of fact, it was very physical in there. It doesn't take him very long to get physical and cause a lot of damage to the body. So, yeah, I felt him, believe me. I felt him a little bit more than I ever felt Flair. So. Okay.
Sting, let me fire a question out here real quick. What was being said in that ring? I was ringside. You and Luger were nose-to-nose out there, and there was a lot of verbal abuse going on from what I could tell. What was being said at that point before the match actually got underway?
Basically, a lot of, well...
Spot calling?
This is the big moment.
Why'd you get so juiced, Lex?
Ready? And of course I said, yeah, I'm ready. And I asked him if he was ready. And of course he was ready. And then there was a little bit of bad mouthing going on, which I really don't want to talk about here right now. But, you know, a little pre-bout conversation there. You can imagine what was said.
Here's your next opponent going to be, Sting.
I'm on a roll.
The next opponent, probably a few people here at World Championship Wrestling. Probably, I'd say,
Hey, wait a minute.
Oh, here we go. Oh, Jesus.
We got the Dangerous Alliance walking in here.
They're all in tuxes except for Rude, who's wearing a Vince McMahon-esque bodybuilding leadership.
But Rude went wearing his robe.
He loves a party. And nobody has more reason to celebrate than you and I. You see... You've got good reason to celebrate because you're the new world champion, and I love it.
Congratulations.
But I've got reason to celebrate because that makes me automatically the number one contender.
Right.
Pour us a cup of drinks,
oh,
there,
yes,
Paul.
Oh, yes, sir. You know I will, Rick. Anything for you. Here's one for Rick, and guess who the other one is for?
So I'd like to propose a toast.
A toast. What a gentleman.
To Sting, the new world champion. And to ravishing Rick Rude, the man who owns the new world champion. Bottoms up, my friend.
I ain't drinking with you, pal. I got no reason to drink with you. I got no reason.
He wins the world title. All of a sudden, he's too good to drink with me. You'll drink with me when I tell you to.
Oh, jeez.
You'll drink
God damn it.
You think you're too good?
Why don't we just do it right now, then?
You want a piece of me now?
Yeah. Let him up, Rick. Let him up. Let him up.
Ruth looks like he's legit trying to control him with front facing.
Well, Ruth was crazy.
Now all the Dangerous Alliance comes in their tuxes.
In their tuxes. And tennis shoes, by the way.
Yep, all dressed like Magnum TA calling a pay-per-view.
Yeah. And Nikita coming out there chasing everybody off in his white jacket.
99-99-100 hotline. Call the hottest hotline. On Sunday.
Call the hotline!
Money
talks. Tuesday, Matt Watch with Steve Beverly. Wednesday, late breaking news with Dennis Brent. Thursday, straight up with Sting. And Saturday, catch the Kill Loss Report.
Oh, these commercials.
Hottest Hotline today. 1-900-909-9900. $2 for the first minute, 45 cents every minute thereafter. Children under 18 must get parental permission.
Which Biggs never got his parents' permission. But, man, that Nikita just showed up out of nowhere. It's like, I remember watching this on television, I'm like, what the hell's he doing?
Well, there's no more USSR.
And why is he up in Sting? Because the last time you saw him, they were feuding with each other. But, wow, what a segment that was. And it's always funny to me, whenever the Alliance would do their tuxes gimmick, Rude never wore tux. He was always the one.
The one standing. Yep.
But, yeah, that was funny. Funny stuff.
I was actually really looking forward to seeing a Sting and Rude match, but like you said earlier, it's one of those things we just never got.
I really like the Clash match, though. I think that's a really underrated match.
It is. Yes, it is.
Yeah. All right. Now, Bix mentioned the bonuses on the show. Jeff Fry awarded Steamboat, Rude, Liger, and Pillman $2,500 each for being the hardest workers on the show. Because in that era, Jeff Fry offered bonuses for for being the best workers. And that's why the guys love working for him. And that's why the shows were so good, because they were wanting to get that bonus.
Interesting, though, that the tag match that we all consensusly said was maybe one of the top 20 matches in WCW history, none of those guys got the bonus.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Well, Dana White only has so much bonus money he can give out each show.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, also in town for the show was Tetsumi Fujinami, who apparently will be winning the NWA World Heavyweight title when they have the tournament. That's funny. Fujinami and Takayuki Iizuka are tentatively scheduled to wrestle the Steiners in a match to determine the number one contenders for the IWGP tag titles held by Bam Bam Bigelow and Big Van Vader at WrestleWar on May 17th in Jacksonville. In the semi-main event to War Games, which will pit Cole, Sting, Steamboat, Rhodes, and Windham versus the Dangerous Alliance. Now, Dave doesn't believe Fujinami is the right choice, but he's got the seniority. He's nothing compared to what he once was, but he is a legitimate legend in the business, but he's hardly known in this country in comparison with Keiji Muto, and isn't the caliber worker these days as either Masahiro Chono or Hiroshi Hase. That's an interesting paragraph to read, isn't it, Matt?
as we know, Fujinami didn't win the NWA championship, but they went with Chono, who had some good matches, but he didn't have any good matches in the United States.
Yeah.
No.
He had him and Rude had that match that was just completely the opposite of what they had a few months earlier in Tokyo.
Yes.
Where they tore the house down in that NWA title tournament finals. But then when, they had the rematch, what was it? Halloween Havoc. And it was just like,
yeah. Ooh.
Yeah.
Now, best estimate from here is about 50% of the guys are on steroids. Since the guys got the letter in the mail on Saturday or Monday of last week, it's too soon to notice any changes as of yet, but the next paper should provide a good indication of how well voluntarily compliance works as a steroid policy works.
Sure.
But the guys who are on should show noticeable changes by early next month. Yes.
Yeah.
Now, go ahead, Matt.
I don't recall seeing a lot of changes.
Not really. And the reason why this is because the week before is when they had the big WWF steroid deal. The locker room was busted, and WCW decided to institute their own policy to try to get ahead of the game. And then you have Luger showing up at Super Bowl like he did. What a complete joke that was. Oh, my goodness. But, yeah, steroid policies in wrestling, it's laughable.
Yeah.
Now, Matt, do you have to leave on us?
I do, unfortunately. Yes, I had a prior booking this evening, so unfortunately, yes.
All right. Well, we're glad to have you on for this first part.
Yeah, definitely. It's been fun, Chris and Dave. I appreciate it, and I'd like to come on again in the future.
Sure. Whenever you get more time, yes.
Yeah, definitely. All right, guys.
Better be a paid booking, though.
It is. Of course it's a paid booking.
And of course, everybody listen to the Indie Riff It podcast and MLW. They hear Matt and you know, co-host. What's it? James Vanderbeek. That's a Twitter handle.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, we do the show once a week. Drops every Monday on MLW Radio. So check us out. Hit me up on Twitter, Matt Farmer 93. And I talk a lot about wrestling history. That's about all. So.
All right. All right, man. We appreciate you being on. We're going to soldier on with the rest of the show.
Appreciate it, guys. You take it easy.
All right. Thanks, man. All right, Biggs. This is the steroid deal here. This is funny stuff. This week here is an interesting week because it's sandwiched in the middle of the steroid scandal and then the Patterson-Garvin scandal, which we'll talk about later. But what is your opinion to this whole steroid situation here?
Well, I mean, we kind of covered it a few weeks ago, I think, when we were talking about Bill Watts, didn't we?
Yeah. This is before, though.
No, I know, but it's the same program, basically. Well, Watts added testing, I think, was what happened. But yeah, this nothing really happened.
No.
For it to work, you have to have, you know, you have to have people think that they'll be punished in some way, you know, whether it's testing that works or whatever. Otherwise, they're not really going to do anything. Well, they're going to do stuff. They're not going to stop doing it.
Yeah. And the one thing that I guess you can say about WCW at this time is they didn't have a lot of guys that were obnoxiously juiced up.
No.
Like WWF did.
Right.
You had guys like Warlord, Davey, you know, guys like that who were just, you know, insanely juiced.
They had Luger, who had gotten much bigger the previous year.
He's gone.
And he's gone. Rude was getting bigger than he had been. Or maybe it just looked bigger in WCW. I don't know. But I mean, I'm trying to think who else. Not really. I mean, you had guys that were muscular, but you didn't have neon signs by and large.
Yeah, Steven Sting, who was on steroids, but it wasn't
Sting
over the
like
top.
An athlete. Sting
now Scott Steiner, that's different.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, he's one, but yeah, it wasn't.
But he also
too
looked
far.
Nothing like he did later.
Oh no. Oh, no, no, no.
But that was a lot more than steroids.
Oh, well, yeah, totally. Now, Terry Gordy and Steve Williams have officially signed, but probably won't be in until around May, working as the heel tag team between Japanese tours. Now, think about Doc and Gordy was around at this time appearing in WCW.
I didn't realize I didn't realize they had signed before Watts came in.
Yeah. But they were working the Japanese tours. So, yeah, but imagine if they were around, you know, in this particular era, you know, in the Kid Fry era, where, you know, they're getting bonuses. Oh, my God, yeah. So that's something to think about. Back to the NWA title tournament. It's very tentatively set for late spring or early summer with attempts to hold a tournament in Japan. Although nothing is concrete as far as Dave knows. And, of course, it was in August.
It was the G1
when they
Climax.
Had it.
Yeah.
And G1 Climax. That's right. And that worked out real well. Now, WCW will lower prices across the board at all arenas in an attempt to bring in new customers. The top seats everywhere will be $12 and $10, with a low general admission price anywhere from $5 to $7, depending upon the market. Which, that's what indie shows basically are these days. You know, it's on the high end.
If I remember correctly, wasn't WWF charging about twice what they were charging at this point?
Yes.
Because I remember
WWF, I think, was already at 25.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Yeah, ringside for WWF was 25 around this time.
And WCW was, you know, you got your money's worth, no doubt, going to their shows.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was very affordable. And great shows. It makes you wonder why, you know, business went down like it did, considering, but, you know, wrestling was on a downward spiral, so whatever. All right, Big Van Vader is negotiating for a 2-year deal where he'd work here in between Japan tours. Now, I guess Vader wasn't on a full-time contract in 91. He just come in and on shots? Or, I mean, what? Or was he on a 1-year deal? Or
I mean, he never really stuck around for programs or anything. So,
well, he got his biggest push though at the end of '91. That's when they took the mask off of him. You know, which I guess, you know, he lost that in Japan, but he didn't have the mask on, and he went with the leather, you know, leather gear, and he started teaming Mr. Hughes and was getting more high profile TV matches in that era.
Yes, and he had the Clash match too a month earlier.
Yeah.
With the Hughes.
And that worked out well. And Vader signed that deal worked out very well for him. That's for sure. Now, speaking of contracts, Johnny B. Badd is in the midst of a contract dispute with management. Several different versions have come Dave's way, but apparently Badd and Kiff Fry agreed to a contract for $156,000 per year, but it wasn't signed. Badd had claimed he wanted better injury benefits, which the contract calls for a specific time period if the wrestler is out of action with an injury that the contracts don't cover him, while others say he asked for more money. Badd had negotiated with Titan, but he had a meeting on Monday with Fry to work things out, but he was pulled from the pay-per-view show because of the dispute. Okay, now, let's think about Johnny Badd and WWF in 1992. How do you think they go with a gimmick like this, repackage him? What do you think they do with Mark Marrow in 92?
I think in 92, if they get him, they do something closer to Johnny B. Badd than they did in 96.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. But this ended up working out better for him because he really started to get better in this era. He started getting, he turned in babyface, and he started to get, you know, in better matches. Because Johnny Badd as a character, he was hit and miss early on, but he finally toned it down enough where he started to get over.
Yes.
And then, of course, he was in the light heavyweight title feuds in this era. And that's people forget about how good he was. He was really good. Really good.
I think he came off. He looked better than he actually was, because he was a guy who figured out how to have a good athletic match. But once he was kind of out of his element in the WWF, except if he was working with certain guys, he wasn't able to really replicate it.
And yeah, but there's a lot of guys like that.
Yeah,
yeah. And there's a lot of guys like that, though.
Sure, but. I bet he improved a lot. He absolutely did. You know, he was having good matches with Regal, with DDP. Who else? Had that really good match with Eddie Guerrero.
Max Payne.
Early Nitros.
Max Payne.
Were the Max Payne matches good? I don't remember them. I don't remember them that much. I mean, I remember the.
I remember one good. One good.
Austin.
Pillman. The Pillman matches I liked in this era. Hmm. God, who else was he working?
I actually really liked his WWF matches against Triple H.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun feud.
I mean, I saw one of them live, and it was really, really good. Like, that was probably... I mean, that probably Triple H's best early WWF matches that weren't against Michaels or anyone like that.
Yeah, I liked his feud with Scotty Flamingo.
Yeah, they had surprisingly deep... They had pretty... Maybe not surprisingly, I don't know. They had solid matches together too. Actually, I'm trying to think. Or am I thinking of the Pillman matches with Flamingo? I don't know.
No, the Sky Flamingo matches were good. No, I mean it got to the boxing stuff. It got a little goofy, but
yeah, the boxing matches.
It was fun though for what it was.
Yeah, I don't think you can fill someone's glove with water and then it becomes an instant knockout blow. That's how water works.
Yeah, but yeah, the Bad Flamingo feuded for almost half a year. They were together for pretty much the second half of '92, and he also got mentioned Ricky Morton too. I remember that.
Richard Morton,
excuse me. And he had some with Tracy Smothers.
Well, it's Tracy.
So I mean, no, yeah, it's Tracy Smothers. That's right. You're right there. Now,
Steve Lane, the only wrestler trained by Ric Flair.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
For those of you,
Bo James, our buddy Bo James, uploaded a video from Nick Gules' Outlaw UWA, where a very, 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 very young Tracy Smothers worked in his first few matches as Steve Lane, which, of course, Steve Kern, Stan Lane, Steve Lane.
Trained by both of the Fabs.
He was trained by the Fabs. And it is hilarious. And again, it's no Vito Marinara.
But that makes him the only wrestler who was trained by the only wrestler who was trained by Ric Flair.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right.
But there are a lot of wrestlers who were trained by the only wrestler who was trained by the only wrestler who was trained by Ric Flair.
Yes, there were. Ric Flair, the godfather. Now, a couple house show notes here. February 24th in Greenville, South Carolina, drew 2,400 with 26,000 on the gate. Liger pinned Morton, who was seven for Pillman. Liger got the biggest pop on the show, and even though injured, did every move under the sun, including a running across the ring and vaulting to the top rope and coming back with a moonsault all in one move for 3.5 stars. This was 1992. Not a lot of people were doing that move.
So what is that? A top rope in ring quebrada then? Sounds like he's...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Big Josh double DQ'd Abdul the Butcher. Mr. Hughes pinned Jimmy Bad. Steiners beat the Young Pistols, all stalling for 19 minutes.
Ooh.
That sounds awesome. Although it was ready to dud. Barry went over Larry Zbysko. Anderson and Eaton over Rhodes and Steamboats when Eaton pinned Rhodes with the Alabama Jam in 3.75 star match. Rude beat Steam by a DQ with a dusty finish, 3.5 stars. So here's what the reason why I put this on here. There was super heat during the Rude and Sting match, but apparently the original orders were for Steamboat to do the job in a tag match. But Dustin volunteered to do the job instead, since if he waits to be asked, he'll be waiting until 1996. Reason why, Dad was the booker. So that's Dave's joke on Dusty. But yeah, that Steiner's Pistols match sounds awesome. Tracy Smothers doing all kinds of stalling bullshit for 19 minutes. Macon, Georgia, my old stomping grounds, on February 25th, drew 2,000. Tom Zeke beat DDP. Terrence Taylor beat Van Hammer. Mr. Hughes beat Big Josh. Steiner's over the Pistols, which was said to be pretty good. Liger over Morton, which was said Liger's worst match on the tour, which he was well aware of, and was throwing things in the locker room because so many moves in the finish were missed. Barry Windham pinned Zbysko, and in a steel cage, Sting, Steamboat, Dustin, and Ron Simmons beat Rude, Eaton, Anderson, and Austin. No, I wasn't at this show, so. But I can only imagine Liger in the locker room just tearing shit up. In Macon, Georgia. That sounds funny. All right. On the February 29th episode of WCW Saturday Night, which aired before, well, wait a minute. It would have aired during Super Brawl.
Yeah.
Because Super Brawl started at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Terrence Taylor and Greg Valentine defeated Big Josh and Ron Simmons for the United States tag titles, taped on February 17th from Rock Hill, South Carolina. The U.S. tag titles, when would you say that they basically lost the credibility?
Who did Josh and Simmons win them from?
Young Pistols.
And the Young Pistols won them from the Freebirds and then turned heel in the middle of the title reign, right?
Yes. So would you say like this, that when Josh and Simmons lost, when they won the belts, because now basically the belts become two random signal guys on the title.
Right. Like it had been losing its luster anyway, but at that point, it's like, well, you know, right? It's just a makeshift team.
Yeah, because the U.S. tag titles are like the work rate titles in some ways.
Right. I mean, quickly, I mean, just if you look at from when they were brought back, you've got Pillman and Z-Man, Midnight, Steiners. They vacate the titles when they win the World Tag Titles. It already starts to lose its luster really after the Steiners vacate the titles, because then it's Freebirds at the point where the Freebirds really shouldn't have been getting any kind of push. Then the Patriots, of Privateide Champion and Firebreaker Chip. Then the Young Pistol. The Young Pistols, I guess they turned heel in the title win, maybe? Then Big Josh and Ron Simmons, then Taylor and Valentine, then the Freebirds as babyfaces. Then the final champions were the Barbarian and Dick Slater.
Yeah, which I love that team. But, it was Greg Valentine, 1992 WCW, was so odd to see, too. Because it seemed like it was 4 years too late. didn't it seem that way?
Yeah.
Like, in 1988, Greg Valentine WCW would have been hot. But, 1992, not so much.
The only now, person there are who thought Greg Valentine was hot around then was Medusa.
Aww. From the Provost of Torch had this information. There are rumblings that Roddy Piper may be coming to WCW when his WWF contract expires, which is soon. And possibly he will bring the Piper's Pit to WCW television.
Oh, that's always a rumor. That rumor comes up every year.
I know. It's just funny that I had to put it in there because it was in the Torch.
Later in the show, are we going to read about how Vince McMahon wants to promote on his own in Japan?
I don't think we have it this week. No, it's one of those rare weeks we don't have it. Now, this is my favorite news item in the whole section. Creative Loafing Magazine, based out of Atlanta, which I'll talk about in a minute, interviewed Missy Hyatt in their February 29th issue. And she addressed the rumors that were going around that she had dated Ted Turner before he met Jane Fonda.
What?
Missy said that she never dated him and only met him once, and that's for a promotional picture. Missy said that she could never date Ted because he's only to be her father. Now, Creative Loafing Magazine,
which still exists
and is a big deal in Atlanta in some circles. To give you a hint of what it is, it's kind of like, I would say the Village Voice in a way, if you're from New York.
But no ads for hookers.
Yes, there is ads for hookers. what Creative Loafing is known for mainly in Atlanta is like the Best of Atlanta list. Like the, whatever, the best restaurants, the best this, that, and the other. And it's a big deal to advertise concerts and stuff like that. It's one of those types of city magazines. It's, on like little stands and stuff. You can get it. And I think it may be still free.
Right. Like the Village Voice. Village Voice is also
free. Like the Village Voice, yeah. And it's a big deal for some people. Some people really, want to get advertised in it because they think it's still the end thing. But they do a lot of stupid shit too, of course. And they have their agendas that they'll run and stuff like that. But this funny that Missy had to address these rumors. Remember when she was on television, was it 1990 when she first came back after she had her voice training lessons to sound less Southern, that which we talked about in the show, that she always talked about going out with Ted. So you think those rumors got started because of the stuff she was saying on the shows?
Probably.
But Missy Hyatt this time, she looked about as different here as she looked. Because this was the time period when she went to a darker hair color. The brownish hair.
Well, she was blonde. She was blonde on the pay-per-view.
Okay, so we've been after this. But, she changed her look in this era. And this is when she's starting to feel Medusa, too, around this time period. So I guess they're trying to, they're giving her a push. But what do you think about all this foolishness?
The first lady of WCW bikini contest and that whole thing. Yes. if I remember correctly, Missy has said that was not fun either, that having to try to get into bikini contest shape, that she was miserable, as you might expect. I kind of like the way her character was during this whole period.
Yeah. I did too. I thought that she was treated more seriously. If you understand, I think she was treated more seriously in this time period.
She's still a comedy character, but she's not treated as brainless.
Yes. Yeah, totally agree. And now let's go to Japan, to All Japan Pro Wrestling. The biggest show this week was on February 27th in Matsumoto, no relation to Dump, before a sellout of 2,600 for a TV taping of a show that aired that Sunday night. The gimmick was a four-match series of matches with Jumbo Shiruda's team of himself, Akira Taue, Masafuchi, and Yoshinari Ogawa against the Super Generation Army of Mitsuharu Misawa, Toshiaki Kawada, Kento Kobashi, and Tsuyoshi Kikuchi. Misawa's squad ended up winning the first three matches to clinch the deal, although Shiruda captured the main event, pinning Kobashi in 21-39 of a super match with his backdrop suplex. Now, Misawa made Taue submit to a face lock in 50-44. Kawada made Fuchi submit with a face lock in 14-24. Kikuchi pinned Ogawa in their match, no time given. Now, also on the card, we have Dr. Death and Terry Gordy over Stan Hansen and Johnny Ace in 22-44 with Gordy pin Ace. Can-Ams meet Dory Funk Jr. and Firecat Brady Boone. And then you had Giant Baba and Rusev Kimura over Haruka Aigen and Motoshi Okuma. And how about this? The State Patrol, Buddy Lee Parker, James Earl Wright defeated Joe and Dean Malenko. And then Mighty Inoue, Masao Inoue, and Osamu Tiranishi went over Satoru Osako, Mitsuo Momota, and Richard Slinger. Bix, what are your thoughts about this interesting group of results?
I feel like I have to know whether or not Can-Ams versus Dory Funk and Brady Boone was for the All-Asian titles.
It didn't say, so I kind of doubt it.
That's a match.
The State Patrol. The State Patrol. All Japan treated them better than any other place treated them. They gave them wins.
Maybe Mrs. Baba was a fan of the Muscle Bears?
Because, of course, James Earl Wright was Dale Veazey, who was a Between Ishii's legend from our show with Dave Prazak.
No, that was Naylor, wasn't it?
No, it was Dave Prazak.
Okay, and then the Muscle Bears was Naylor.
It was Naylor.
Or did Veazey on the Prazak show?
Yeah, no, it was Naylor. So if you want to listen to the Dale Veazey Muscle Bears deal, go listen to the last few minutes of that show and you'll get the whole gist. But Joe and Dean Malenko, who were, fairly credible in All Japan, doing the honors for State Patrol on a TV taping.
Yes.
So good for them.
Definitely better trainers than Buddy Lee Parker.
Well, now, Firecat. I vaguely remember that Firecat gimmick.
Well, it was just, he was a Battle Cat, just with a different name.
Yeah. Brady Boone's a guy who I thought would have been better. I guess he was too short. That's why he didn't get treated more credibly, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, do you really want to have a Tiger Mask knockoff in Japan?
No, you don't. No, you don't.
So why couldn't he just be Brady Boone?
Yeah, I know. That's a weird deal. Now, going to New Japan, we talked about Tetsumi Fujinami earlier. He wants to go to WCW for an extended trip as part of an angle where he's fed up with New Japan. No word if it materialized. Well, it did. So there you go. And I don't think he would have fit in anyway.
No.
In WCW.
No.
And I love Fujinami. He's probably one of the top five greatest wrestlers ever. Maybe the greatest wrestler ever in Japan. But I don't know. Just, it wasn't the right time, right place.
No.
Speaking of Tiger Mask, that's a good segue here. New Japan will debut a new Tiger Mask on March the 1st at their big show at Yokohama Arena. It'll be prelim boy Koji Kanemoto that has to fill the shoes, originally created by the legendary Satoru Sayama, and then filled by Masaharu Misawa. So there was some talk 1 year ago that if Yoshihiro Asai had jumped to New Japan rather than SWS, that he would have used a Tiger Mask gimmick. Tiger Mask will face El Samurai in his debut match. That's interesting. I wonder how Asai's career goes as Tiger Mask 3.
Especially since Sayama was his hero and he's a guy who could have lived up to it.
Yes. Because in all honesty, I mean, Kanemoto we love, but Kanemoto didn't become Kanemoto until he unmasked and turned heel.
Right.
When he was one of the best in the world in the latter 90s.
And we knew that Asai would have been able to work under a mask.
Yes, and was more explosive.
Yeah.
And he did the Asai moonsault and all the other dives and stuff. And him in New Japan for an extended amount of time would have been, I mean, tremendous. Working that group of guys of what he was working against.
I wonder if they made an offer to him. I wonder if he got some satisfaction out of being able to turn them down.
Probably.
Because for those who don't know, he trained in the dojo, but then they decided not to hire him because they thought he was too small.
Yeah, and he stayed in Mexico.
How many guys did that happen with? Were they agreed to take him on, but then didn't sign them after
the dojo? I mean, there were guys that were... The dojo stores could go different ways. I mean, you had guys that were there and left, like Hisakatsu Oya. You had guys like Riki Fuji, who I think went to Canada and never came back until later on. I mean, there were all kinds of different stories about different guys. You know, Gato and Jado were New Japan guys originally, in the dojo.
Takeshi Pure Sogunden, or did those guys train out of the New Japan dojo?
Well, same thing. Same type of deal. But, I mean, they were part of that crew as well. Wait,
Super Delphin also New Japan Dojo then?
He may have had experience there, yes. Yeah.
Hmm.
Could have been. I mean, there were different guys that was in and out of there for short amounts of time. So it could very easily could have been part of it.
But, yeah, I mean, I think there's probably part of them that would have gotten satisfaction out of turning them down.
Yes. Now, PWFG, Pro Wrestling Fujiwara Gumi, ran a show on February 24th at Corican Hall. Drew in a sellout of, I love this, 2,300. This is, of course, before they actually knew what the real numbers were in the building. And there were some Corican shows in the 80s that they would claim to draw 3,000 fans. Which, if you see Corican Hall, there's no way in hell you get 3,000 fans in there.
I can almost buy it for an All Japan Women show because they packed everyone in there so tight.
Yeah.
But not really.
Yeah. Now, Masakazu Funaki made Wayne Shamrock submit in 40 minutes. Of course, Ken Shamrock.
Did you say
Wayne Shamrock.
Or 14?
Minoru, 40 minutes.
4-0.
Minoru Suzuki made Jerry Flynn submit in 8:46. Yoshiaki Fujiwara beat Yusuke Fuke by a 5-knockdown rule in 15:58. Bart Vale defeated Kazuo Takahashi, and El Kaleo defeated Wellington Wilkins Jr.
El
Kaleo, I don't know.
What?
I don't know. I got to look this up. 40 minutes. What do you think, Bix? 40 minutes of Funaki and Shamrock.
Is this show on tape? I mean, that's interesting.
It's gotta be, I would think.
I don't know. That sounds maybe like too much.
I'm looking at the spelling of this, and there's nothing there.
For what?
Kaleo.
Oh.
So I'm trying to see. All right, real quick while I'm looking for this.
Look up the card on Wrestling Data.
Yeah, what were your thoughts about PWFG?
In this era, you mean, or later on, or both?
In this era.
It's interesting because it's the Pancrase guys doing pro wrestling. I mean, some of them had been in UWF, but... But you also have guys like Sano mixed in. I think having someone like Sano around is kind of what makes it more interesting, say, than UWF, that you had him in the mix and he was so good. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, 40 minutes is correct. And the name was Lato Kiralik.
And what is he? Does he have a profile if you click his name?
He worked at PWFG quite a bit. 91, 92. And it looks like he was just a guy.
Lato Kiralik?
Kiralik.
Kiralik? Lato Kiralik?
Yeah, K-I-R-A-W-A-R-I-K.
So probably just some random Carl Gotch trained guy.
Yes. 40 minutes for Naki Shamrock. And it's on DVD too, that show.
Okay.
Mike Lorfice, I think, had it on his Quibrada site. Because I saw it mentioned there. So there you go.
Okay.
All right. Going to another shoot style group, UWFI, who drew a sellout of 2,600 to Corkin
Hall.
On February 29th. As Gary Albright pinned the Masahito Kakihara in 2:28 in the main event to help build up Albright versus Takada, which mostly figured the March 17th show in Nagoya. That's right. Gary Albright, Masahito Kakihara was a main event of a UWFI show at Corkin Hall. Now, Takada on this show beat Mark Fleming, former Jim Crockett Promotions jobber, protege of Luthez, with an arm lock. Kazuo Yamazaki defeated Tom Burton. That's right. The Dirty White Boy, Tom Burton.
Also, also Tom Davis of the Dirty Davis Brothers.
Of the Dirty Davis Brothers. That's right. Now, Yoji Anjo beat Yuko Miyato. Kiyoshi Tamura beat Mark Silver. And your other match, Tatsuo Nakano defeated Pistol Pez Watley. Now, how did we not get Takada versus Watley, Vix? Imagine that match.
No, they should start out as a tag team, and then Takada, because as we know, he's an idiot. He would call Pez the greatest black wrestler of all time, and then Pez would turn on him, and they'd feud.
Oh, man. Pistol Pez won't need to be fine, but... Wally versus Tamara. Imagine that match. God, Wally versus Anjo. God, there's so many matches that could have been held. That's just an odd name in UWFI. But the thing is, Wally was a very accomplished amateur wrestler.
Well, that's how they were picking those guys. I mean, think about who they brought in. Steve Cox, Iron
Do Teak. It to it, Steve Cox. Yep.
I'm Steve, do it to it, Cox, and I just don't care. Bad News Allen. Who else? I guess it was Tommy Cairo, a good amateur.
Was an Iron Man. We know that.
And we know that when Tom he's Burton. In his garden with his vegetables and his fruits, he sits around eating peaches.
Tom Burton. I only imagine his amateur wrestling prowess.
I guess I don't know.
Yeah, UWFI. What a wacky group of gaijin. Well, moving on to JWP, as talk is the now defunct JWP women's group will end up with two different promotions being formed that will debut over the spring and summer with a talent split between the two groups.
Now defunct. What?
Yeah, that's what it said.
Well,
the now defunct JWP.
Well, they became undefunct.
Yeah, they did.
That's strange.
In fact, what happened was, okay, this was the original JWP Vix. The new JWP started in April 3rd.
Okay, that's right. I didn't realize that the original was still around in 92.
Yeah, here's the story. JWP was founded in April 3rd, 1992, with Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, JWP, ravaged by internal politics, split up into two camps dubbed the Shooters and the Entertainers.
Gee, I wonder which went where.
The Shooter side went on to form Ladies Legend Pro Wrestling, while the Entertainer side, led by Jackie Sato and financed by Masatoshi Yamamoto, became this JWP we're talking about here. So there you go.
Huh.
So that's how LLPW was born.
Why'd they get to
which
get
will name? Be talk? I guess LLPW wanted to be different. I don't know. They wanted anyone to have
the... So by different, you mean not good?
They didn't want the stench of the JWP name, I guess. And we'll be talking about more about LLPW stuff later on in the show, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
But on that note, we're going to take a quick break and let the Place to Be boys pay the bills. When we come back, we go to Mexico, where we're going to talk about one of those Pacific Northwest guys earlier, who's one of the nicest guys you would ever want to meet, and things he did in Mexico that rubbed people the wrong way. We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tourneaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
And we're back. This is one of those great shows you heard mentioned in that break. Now, before we go on to Mexico, that we talked about before the break, let's go ahead and get our plug in for Amazon. If you shop on Amazon.com, do us a solid, man. Go to tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon, and that's our referral link. And whenever you buy anything from Amazon, we get a little piece of the pot. So
you don't have
help,
to pay
help a couple of brothers out.
Don't have to pay anything
extra. Yeah. No, you don't. You don't have to pay anything extra at all. It's just a courtesy to us, help a couple brothers out as we try to provide you with quality entertainment each week. And
we fail.
Yeah, man. Just hey, sometimes we do good, sometimes we don't. Not everything's a home run. You know,
but
sometimes you have hits, sometimes you have misses.
I was kidding. But yes, tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon.
Yes. And since we're doing Mexico, I'll do it for Big. So go to luchashop.com, check out our friends over there. And if you use the coupon, or as Big says, coupon code Bix, you save 10% off of your purchases. And they got a lot of cool stuff going on. If you follow them on Twitter, they got a lot of Pentagon Junior stuff, Paris Del Mall, Ingobernales, all kind of goodies. So go check them out. Coupon code Bix, save 10% off.
Now, wait a second. So it's a coupon versus coupon and North-South thing?
Probably. I just love saying coupon.
Okay.
I don't know. That's why I was told to say it. I guess it's a Southern thing. You say potato, I say potato.
I don't say potato.
You say tomato, I say tomato.
I don't say any of those.
You never heard that song?
I know the song.
Yeah. Anyway. That great Pacific Northwest star, Art Barr, leads off here. A very kind man. And he's working in Mexico as a love machine, still masked. But he may not be around much longer, as he's in trouble for apparently sucker punching Blue Panther in the office. And promoter Paco Alonso had to break it up.
What?
Now, if I'm going to sucker punch a guy, Blue Panther is not one of them I would try to mess with. Blue Panther is known for being quite the technician. He can handle himself. So, in Art Barr, I mean, the stories we've heard about him, I mean, he was a loose cannon. And he definitely wasn't long for his promotion because he lost his mask a month later and he was gone. Went with AAA with Pena and crew.
Yeah, could you imagine sucker punching Blue Panther? He'd get wrapped up in a noodle log and arrow in no time.
Yeah, but it didn't stop from having that awesome mask match, that's for sure. They were at least professional. And what a great feud that was, too. Yeah. Probably Art Barr's best feud. As a single.
Yeah, for sure.
And watch that mask match. Because, I mean, Blue Panther, if I'm not mistaken, he's carried out to the ring by the fans who are all singing his theme song, La Puerta Negra. Just an awesome spectacle. Awesome spectacle.
Wasn't Love Machine still technically a babyface?
Yes. That's the funny part about it. On February 23rd, Arena Mexico, it was headlined for the third straight week by Solomon and Aaron Grundy.
Oh, Christ.
With Mike Shaw, Muck and Singh Norman, and Vampiro, or as he's known as here, Canadian Vampire Casanova, beating Los Hermanos Dinamita. Mascara y Unos Mil, Cien Caras, Universo Dos Mil. Dave said the fans put everyone in the match except for Vampiro. Now, the February 28th show. Now, all right, you can tell the difference between Arena Mexico shows were booked differently. And you can tell which shows were booked by Antonio Pena and which shows were not booked by Antonio Pena.
They because were this by, show. What's his name? Juan Herrera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Antonio Pena booked the 28th show, which is another hot one, headlined by Pirata Morgan, Benny Massacre, and a Caballero contra Caballero match. Both guys used heavily and were biting each other's cuts, which Dave says shows AIDS awareness at its highest point. Morgan won the third ball via submission about them in 20 minutes, 3.25 stars. Also, Conan, Rayo de Jalisco Jr. and Pedro Aguayo, beat Sangre Chicana, Cien Caras, and Mascaraña 2000 in 2 falls. Second falls ended with a heels DQ because they wouldn't pin Conan. All the faces were left laying when it was over to set up the next week's main event, another 3.25 star match. That ain't the best match on the shows. Best match on the show, so Octagon, Mascara Sagrada, and Lismark over Emilio Charles Jr., Jerry Estrada, and Perloff Jr. 13-14, Estrada and Perloff both juice, 3.75 stars. The opener saw Minis Espectrito Jr. and Pequeño Perloff beat Mascarilla Sagrada, who Dave says the greatest midget wrestler there's ever been, and Octagoncito, 15-13, 2.75 stars. Yes, this show is stacked.
Now, is this the same Pequeño Pierroth that was around years later, or a different one?
I think it's always been the same guy.
He was around a long time. I could be wrong with that,
but he still goes. He still works now. If it's not the same guy, there's only been like two.
Right.
But yeah, they are really hot this time period, and the split's coming. But, yeah, a lot of great, great names on this show. Now, speaking of Conan, rival promoter Benjamin Mora, who was a running feud with Conan and published his Lucha Libre magazine while promoting in Baja California, brought in a bodybuilder who used to wrestle as Drago as the new Conan and wore Conan's old mask. However, Antonio Pena took legal action since the Conan name is registered and he had to change his name to El Colosso. Mora also published some photos of natural versus synthetic with a photo of Konek as natural and Konek as synthetic, which Dave says, Konek ain't natural, folks. Yeah. Those feuds are always fun, the promoter feuds and stuff like that, especially when you have the magazines involved.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it could get really, really nasty.
I didn't realize that there was a Tijuana fake Konek, though. It I knew about the Monterey fake Konek. I did not know about the...
Who still works.
All of them?
Well, Konek Big, I guess. Is that the one you're thinking about?
Well, you had Konek Big, you had Scott Putski as Konek 2000, which I believe was on Monterey, right?
Yeah.
You had Konek Gay. Not making that up.
Nope.
I feel like I'm forgetting one.
I think you hit them all in the head. But yeah, Konek had a lot of heat from a lot of different people in that era. So does today. But yeah, he was a big deal though, big time star though. That was his prime as a box office star.
May he rest in peace.
Yeah. And natural versus synthetic, that's funny. Steroids in Mexico. Ah, UWA, El Torreo on the 23rd. We had, the main event was Konek, Fishman, and Dos Caras over Bam Bam Bigelow and the Samoan SWAT team. Fatu and Samoan Savage by DQ, and Bigelow fouled Konek as the Konek body slammed him. Also on this show, we had Gran Hamada and Los Cowboys, Silver King of Tejano, going to a draw with Dr. Wagner Jr., Negro Casas, and Rambo, double pinfall with Casas and Hamada.
That sounds really good.
Yeah, we had La Muerte and Canadian Tiger and The Killer beating Enrique Vera, Solo Uno, and El Fantasma, two straight falls.
That doesn't sound so good.
Muerte Pin Vera, the hair match, the March the 1st. But yeah, Babyface and Ellen Dringo and Espanto Jr. over Super Roton, Super Pinocchio, and Celestial. And your opener saw Katana and Late Lasser and El Hakon 78 over Ricky Boy, Momotaro, and El Falcon. Bam Bam Bigelow, he worked quite a bit in UWA in this year, this time period.
Yeah, and that's when they had TV, so some of that's on videotape.
Yeah.
92 UWA ain't that good, though.
No, it's not that great, but it has some fun stuff on there. It's a fun watch.
Some stuff's fun. You know, you got, you know, like
Can-Ams.
Can-Ams.
Tony Anthony.
Sasuke coming in to wrestle. Yeah. I'm working with Cassandra.
Yeah, I mean, there's some fun stuff. It just because it's fun, I mean, it's good. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
It's hit or miss.
Now, La Muerte is a wrestler from Guatemala who was being brought in for the feud with Vera. So if you don't know who La Muerte is, there you go.
The Guatemalan lucha we've seen is good, though.
Yeah?
The very little we've seen.
Yeah.
Better than the Panamanian lucha we've seen.
Come on. It's got some great content for your show, 605 Super Podcast.
Why? Which promotion was Panamanian?
Oh, is it P-Bray? Which one is that?
No, Titani's NL ring is Argentina.
That's right. That's right. I got my countries confused there. I totally forgot about that. Yeah, that's Argentina. Yeah, Guatemala still runs today. I mean, there's still two successful buildings that they run every Sunday. So they still do business. Now, Silver King and Tejano defended their UWA tag titles against Negro Casas and Espanto Jr. on February the 24th at Arena Puebla.
Ooh.
And at Arena Neza on... in Arena... What?
Just that match. It's so good.
Yeah, I know. And then on February 28th at Arena Neza, the main event was a career versus Caballero match with Tombo the Flying Elephant putting his career on the line and having to retire if he lost to the Canadian Tiger, Mike Lozanski, and Tomba lost.
Well,
Tomba retired. How much Tomba have you seen, Bix?
I'm not sure if I've seen anything from when the elephant could still fly.
Interesting character for that way.
Yes.
And on the 29th, Gran Hamada beat El Engendro in a Caballero contra Caballero match in Cuernavaca. So a lot from UWA this week. A lot of stuff going on. Busy promotion.
That would change before long.
Oh, yes, it would. But in promotions that are in the news, especially in this era, the Global Wrestling Federation, and they have reduced the numbers of comp tickets. So the crowd on February 28th at the Sportatorium was down to 500 fans. It was close to like 1,000, I think, before that. I mean, they were having pretty good houses, but hey, they want you to pay, damn it.
But so, but Gray Pierce, was it Gray Pearson yet, or was it still Max Andrews or whoever?
It was Max Andrews.
Because I know when Gray Pearson was in charge, because he was the one who really ramps up all the freebies and all that, he had control of the concessions and the parking and stuff, so he would still make money off people getting in for free.
Yeah.
I don't know if they had the same arrangement before that, but it's not like it was not the it was not as stupid as it sounds.
No, no. Now, they taped television on the show from March 23rd. Barry Horowitz pinned Ben Jordan. When Bruce Pritchard held his feet, so Horowitz retained his GWF light heavyweight title. Bullpen and Black Bart beat Wild Bill Irwin and Rattlesnake Race in a double bull rope match. John Tam and Rob Price beat Gary Young and Scott Puskey to keep the GWF tag titles. Then on for March 25th on ESPN, the Dark Patriot, Doug Gilbert, beat Terry Garvin via countout. Black Bart won a 10-man tape fist battle royal to become the first GWF Brass Knuckles champion, where Bart used the Brandon Iron on Irwin to win the title. Then for March 30th on ESPN, Bart Patriot, Big Bad John. Who's Big Bad John here, Bex?
Is this the WCW Big Bad John?
I don't know. I can't remember.
This is
whoever he was.
This is the one that Rob Naylor calls Big Bad John, because it was like his entrance music went like that or something.
Yeah. And he beat Brian Ferrar and Mike Reed in a terrible match. Bullpen drew Wabal Irwin. Ben Jordan over Barry Horowitz by DQ. Black Bart beat Young. Winter Brandon Iron. In your dark match main event, Eddie Gilbert, who only worked the dark match, and you about to understand why, and Terry Garvin beat the Dark Patriot and Big Bad John. Eddie pinned his brother Doug and hit him with a chain. After the match, Eddie was attacked and bled buckets and did a stretcher job. They are doing dark matches in the turn to perk up the house show attendance, since previously all the matches eventually aired on television, and also to use juice since it's banned by ESPN.
Hmm.
Now, why was Eddie Gilbert only working the dark match? Well, here's why. Jeff Gaylord showed up Friday night looking for a job and apparently asked Gilbert why he hadn't hired him. Of course, Eddie had booked Jeff Gaylord numerous times in promotions he had. Gilbert said because he didn't even know Gaylord was looking for a job. Apparently told him he had the next 4 weeks booked, so he couldn't use him until then. Gaylord claimed that he had told Skinner right about weeks ago that he was looking for work, and Gilbert said he hadn't heard about him. Apparently, this didn't go as diplomatic as it sounds, because Gaylord sucker-punched Gilbert and was pounding on him until Doug hit Gaylord in the head with a Coke bottle, and Gaylord left the building bleeding all over while Eddie had a puffed-out face from the punches that landed. Joe Pettisino apparently decided that Gaylord will never work for the GWF in the future. Which, didn't he work in the GWF later on?
I don't remember, actually.
Okay. But, yeah. We talked about this before with Eddie, but and doing something about Eddie. We mentioned the Jeff Gaylord deal, but that was, like I said, Eddie always booked Jeff Gaylord just about everywhere he went. That was weird that they had this falling out like they did.
Yeah, I mean, when you consider that, I would guess that this was on Gaylord and not Eddie.
You think it may have been roid rage?
If you say so.
But anyway, what do you think about this? The global results I read earlier. I mean, this is where you start seeing some of the names starting to change.
What, you're not a Jeff Rates fan?
No, but you're starting to see more of the Texas guys being used more.
I mean, I liked the Barry Horowitz Ben Jordan program.
Well, this is Barry Horowitz's best run.
Yes, I thought that was a fun little deal where he's Barry the Winter Horowitz, and then they do the thing where they actually kind of did the gimmick he did with Skip with in reverse with Ben Jordan, because Ben Jordan won the title from him when he couldn't What was it that if Horowitz didn't beat him twice in 10 minutes, something like that?
Yeah.
And then they did the opposite where Skip didn't beat Horowitz twice in 10 minutes, he'd lose.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing that was his idea. But yeah, aside from like the Gilbert stuff, I mean, he's booking, but I mean, aside from his matches, the Barry Horowitz stuff and Bolt Payne, not great up and down the cards. Although the booking's good.
No. Yeah. There is some good booking, that's for sure. Now, USWA has some other stuff going on. And on the 24th in Memphis, Coco Beware won the USWA title from Kamala in a match where Ware put up his bird Frankie against the title. Now, in the interviews the Saturday before, Dennis Corluzzo, who does taped interviews for Kamala from New Jersey, said that when Kamala won, he'd eat Frankie in the ring. Now, the finish saw a ref bump, and Tony Fault gave Friday, who's being played by Buddy Wayne, an object. But before Kamala could use it, Ware drop-kicked him, used it on Kamala, and pinned him. Now, Bix, we know that Dennis Corluzzo has become a legend thanks to the 605 Super Podcast. But we had this promo, do we not? So let's let the fans hear from Dennis himself.
He's already a legend.
Eddie Marlin, you senile old geezer. Jerry Jarrett, you crook. I have had it with you. For the longest time now, we have been beating up on Coco Ware. We're tired of looking at him. We're tired of smelling him. You have continually swerved my client, as you have done in the past. We beat Coco Ware. We beat him again, you hold the belt up. We then let you put his handler in a cage. And he comes begging to use guys that he wants one more title.
Use guys.
Well, Coco, we have everything to lose and nothing to gain by giving you one more title shot. And we have done everything asked of us. Now, if you want a title shot, you got to put something up. And it's the only way you're going to get it. Now, we don't want your money because we know you don't have any of that. We don't want that 62 Pontiac you drive around in either. We don't want that dilapidated house behind Beale Street that you and your 14 kids and your ugly old lady live in, where we hear you got cockroaches as big as dogs, and the kids use them as pets. You can keep your house, you can keep your pets, and the kids can keep all their lead paint chips they want to eat. All right? We want something that's more important to you than your family, your money, your car, your ugly old lady. What we want is that disease-infested chicken that you snuck into the country and dyed its feathers and trying to push off as a parrot. That's right, Coco. We want Frankie. You put up Frankie, all right? That Monday night, the Mid-South Coliseum, that's what we want you to do.
And police are in the background. The belt,
Kamala gets Frankie. And wait till you see what he does with him. He's going to do it right at ringside there, and everybody there that's watching is going to see what's happening. And I cannot wait to see this myself. So, Coco, you want the title shot, you put up Frankie. That's the bottom line. Also, I'm expecting to receive an award from the Department of Health for getting rid of that disease-infested chicken that you'll be bringing to the ring with you. And also, Coco, just be there with that bird if you want the title shot. And one more thing. When we're done with you, Laura, I got some unfinished business with you.
Now, he's cutting this promo, by the way, wearing a New York Mets satin starter jacket, which is phenomenal. But the police sirens are awesome touch. Because they're Nicole Luther.
Yeah, like they did that on purpose.
Yeah, you know, like it's a, you know, basically he's playing like a mob character anyway. So it's just classic stuff. But
he's the wrestling star.
Yes. It always was funny to me how Dennis could have been used so much more in his Southern territories in the '90s. He'd have been awesome as a manager.
Yeah, but he has his day job. He's not going to go to Memphis.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of not going to Memphis, Austin Idol is already history after drawing two of the biggest Memphis houses in a long time. Well, it is Austin Idol, who I loved at one old wrestling poster I posted on Twitter recently. Idol was spelled I-D-L-E. Rib, I don't know.
Well,
now, this era,
wasn't there the thing that wasn't there like a typo early on? And Larry Hart said in his book that Dennis McCord, when he first became Austin Idol, wanted to be called Austin Idol. but he said that Bob Osh wouldn't go for it, so he changed it to Austin Idol, and that he didn't like that. But then he went with it anyway. But in his shoot interview, Idol said that that was a typo, that was in his
error,
and that it was always supposed to be Austin Idol, that it was never supposed to be Austin Idol.
Now, this time period, USWA was booked by Eric Embry. And a lot of women were in the USWA in this time period, mainly because Eric Embry liked women. Well, CJ, who was Embry's valet, left last week and claimed sexual harassment on the part of Eric Embry, and no word on how this will all be settled. Eric Embry, sexual harassment on a woman? Come on, Bix.
Well, maybe he just he continued his habit of walking around the dressing room naked. I mean, it would honestly not shock me if it was something like that. Not that it's good, but... Not that anything would shock me either, but...
Yeah. Now, there's, like, let's see, who? Lauren Davenport.
Leslie Bellinger.
Dirty White Girl. Miss Texas. God, there were so many women. Tony Adams later on. There's so many women that was coming in on Memphis' time period. It was crazy. They're always getting stripped.
Yep.
Very misogynist, folks. Very misogynist.
And they got a lot of criticism for it back then. More than you'd probably think they would, given the time period.
Yeah. It was over the top. It was too much.
Yeah, I remember Jerry Jarrett in a Torch Talk defending it and not doing a good job.
Well, you know.
I'm trying to remember, though. It's like he's like, well, we have what's called whatever the name they used. Right? I mean, it's a lingerie brawl, but it was something like that. It might be on the Torch side if I looked it up, but it was.
He was trying to explain that this was a part of the match. It was,
oh, you remember?
You know,
okay,
the match
this? Yeah.
Yeah. He was trying to explain that we have to have this match to fill this gimmick. They have to be in lingerie. Hilarious. Now, on the live show on the 29th, the Fat Boys, not the rap group, or as they were known as Meat and Potatoes, made their debut doing a PNU's tribute gimmick, and they blew up 5 seconds into their match with Invader and Shadow, who just were wrestling. After the match, they were so winded they could barely speak more than a word at a time. And guess what, folks? We have the Fat Boys.
Actually, you know what? I have a suggestion. So what I think we should do, since this is actually a match, I am going to use one of those YouTube syncing things and send you the link so we can watch it together.
Okay.
Across the country. So, well, I guess it's not across the country. It's kind of like downward, and it's not across the street. It's down the street, but with the country. Okay, so let's see. So I will add this here. Say something. Stall for a second while I do this.
But anyway, this time period, USWA had been criticized for copying WWF. Well, on this week of television, they do this PN News deal. They have a woman doing an Alexandra York gimmick.
Wait, who was that? I sent you the link, by the way.
Yeah, they couldn't. They didn't give a name. I can't remember who it was. But, she sat there with a business suit. So, yeah, they were not original. Okay.
All right, you've got it?
Yes.
Now, like I said in the chat, now mute yours, though, because that you're
going to hear
it through Skype. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
You got it?
Yes.
All right, here we go.
And the celebration right there. Here's the music. That's Chubby Checker in the background.
Yeah.
Here come the Fat Boys right
there. Oh, my God. Now, why did you wipe out?
We don't know too much about them, but we've heard good things about them.
Because then the idea, then we think they were... kind of pretending to be both halves.
They head around the ring. Their opponents are already in the ring right now. The Shadow and the
Invader. Yes, they are fat boys.
15-minute time limit match scheduled.
They're
not
kicked
off.
Oh, my God. Look at
that kid.
You got someone over there doing the twist with them.
But that one guy's not as fat as the other one. The first one.
They're not that big, though. It's not like
that guy is.
Glad to have him here, too. The fat boys. Eat potatoes. I don't know which is which, tell you the truth. Maybe we can talk to him a little bit later and find out.
No, let's not.
It's certainly
correct. Talking to
the,
Backlund.
To the young fans there. One young
now, these mask jobbers are full mask jobbers. Full suits.
Hang back close to mom there, I think. They head into the ring, and we are going to be ready to go. Boy, they have a terrific weight advantage.
Okay, there's the bell.
Going into this one.
Now, one thing we're going to say, they at least they wrestle on television. I'll let that metal guy.
Metal Ed.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Fat boys. Come back with a little retreat of their own. They
oh, my God.
The one with the dark hair is completely blown up after giving one body slam.
Picking him up.
Yes.
They don't know which one is meat. Don't know which one is potatoes.
This is exactly how you'd expect Corey Macklin to call the central. I don't know which one is meat. I don't know which one's potatoes.
That one guy looks like Typhoon with Down syndrome. Oh, my God. That diving elbow on the top of the head. Oh.
The Invader and the Shadow.
That was worthy of Coco Ware.
Off by jumping.
Oh, my God.
The bell sounded. I don't know if it's done. Good. Whoa, what a power slam.
The blind one is not bad in terms of conditioning.
They are redefining.
Why is it Frank Morrell getting one of them guys out of the ring?
Oh, my God. I hope he didn't just. I think he just killed the guy jobber with the flapjack.
That was a spike flapjack. Oh!
One, two, three, they get it.
Now, why did Frank Morrell get that fat ass out of the ring?
I think it's to say these guys are green.
Green? Shit, they're fucking damn, like, the Masters, Augusta National, you know, green, as far as the grass. I mean, it's ridiculous here. I mean, God almighty.
Let's watch that finishing sequence again.
That fat fuck, I mean, he can't do nothing.
Wait, let's see this flapjack.
They are redefining tag team rules here, however.
That was a flapjack 92.
Remember on the first WXO show when Frankie Lancaster and the other guy nearly killed Danny Dominion?
Yes.
This was worse than that.
Yes. Terrible.
So now, do we have a post-match promo or something?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. That's the best part. And then they are shaking hands again, so they're about to get blown up again. The fans got into them, though. We'll say that.
See what they have to say about the situation. The ring.
Memphis fans are easy, though.
The supports that go underneath the ring, there are a couple of big eye hooks that
gee, I've never heard that about that territory.
Together. But here they come. Meat and potatoes and guys, which is...
Oh, here we go.
For those of you who hadn't seen us before, we're the Fat Boys. I'm meat, this is potatoes. Hey, I thought I was meat and you was potatoes. But that don't matter. You see, we smell some dogs in town.
Yeah, the moon dogs are around here.
Oh, I wouldn't want them.
And by the smell, there's some pretty stinky dogs, too. And let me tell you something. Dogs, anytime you want to come down, we got meat and potatoes for all of you. Come on, baby. Anytime.
Well, I tell you what, an impressive debut right here today in the USWA from the Fat Boys. Meat and potatoes, or is it meat and potatoes? We're glad to have you here. Good luck against the Moondogs. The Moondogs, of course, have been running wild over everybody. The Fat Boys, a fun-loving group, no doubt about it. And they are going to be looking for the Moondogs, they say, all around the USWA. And, well, we'll see. Maybe these guys can help slow them down.
No, Dave. They did not help slow them down. In fact, I think that was their only television appearance. I'm trying to see if they even worked the Coliseum.
They found out they worked against the Moondogs and they fled.
Well, here, all right. They beat Tony Falk and Jim Steele that Monday night at the Coliseum.
The Fat Boys against Jungle Jim Steele.
And that was the only match that worked in Mid-South Coliseum.
I will repeat. These guys wrestled 1992 Jungle Jim Steele.
That was the only match they worked at Mid-South Coliseum was that match.
In a manner of speaking.
Tony Falk and Jim Steele. Here we go, David! Cody Maclin. Oh, man. Oh.
Wow.
We got one thing. We got to give credit to our buddy Tim Evans. He's the one that uploaded all the Core Loser stuff and the Fat Boys on YouTube.
And Kick-Ass Wrestling at the Women's Prison.
Yeah, just a great, great internet personality. All right, moving on to Potpourri. Yeah, good little bit of Potpourri today, folks. Former WF wrestler Paul Roma, who appeared on the Wrestling Insiders radio show on the 29th, makes his pro boxing debut this coming Friday.
Oh, no.
Roma said his weight has dropped from 250 to 215 for boxing. Gee, I wonder why. 15 pounds of which he attributes to getting off steroids. He said he had no problems withdrawing from steroids, even though others have. Then he felt steroids were a necessary evil one in the WWF. Roma said in order to get a release from Titan Sports to keep his Glory nickname, he had a signed deal that said he would give Titan Sports no negative publicity, although he termed his stay there, quote, 6 years of hell. I think that's pretty negative publicity, Mix.
Sure.
And he ended up being on steroids.
Yeah, there's that too. That's negative publicity.
Paul Roma. I like Paul Roma Power and Glory. I thought that was his best run.
Yeah. That guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's something else. All right. Moving on. Vern Gagne and... Huh?
Speaking of something else.
Yeah. Vern Gagne and Brad Rangins are negotiating with TGP Productions for a syndicated amateur wrestling show on television. Yikes.
Yes, because Vern didn't lose enough when he lost his house to Eminent Domain.
Yeah. Now, for those of you that listen to the Scott Huss and Steve Brazak episode of Exile on Bad Street,
yeah, I want
these next news bites are for you. Eddie Gilbert will now be hosting Pro Wrestling This Week in Atlanta with Sammy Kent, while Teddy Long will be in the studio each week introducing the Worldwide Show on Channel 69. Joe Pedicino will be back with Bonnie Blackstone as the host of the Saturday Night Wrestling Block, which happened. It was funny when Joe came back. When Joe came back, that was a great episode.
I want to see Eddie Gilbert and Uncle Sammy.
No. And we're not done with Uncle Sammy yet.
Well, how was that, though? How was Eddie Gilbert, the Eddie Gilbert Uncle Sammy pairing?
It didn't last long. I vaguely remember it. Okay. It just didn't go long because they were, I think it was May or June is when they quit. They were, I guess, canceled. So sad day. All right. Sir Sammy, Samuel Kent, is starting up a North Georgia promotion and television show, which will air in Atlanta with the Georgia regulars. This would become North Georgia Wrestling. That Scott Huss and Steve Praise I talked about on the show.
Home of Lugging Up the Salvage Guy.
Yeah, and speaking of that, on the February 23rd at the Auction Barn in Alpharetta, drawing 70 fans, Dino Manelli and Steve Lawler, who, if you heard Scott Huss talk about Steve Lawler on that show, he's absolutely right. That's a guy who maybe video will surface of him. Because he's a guy that nobody knows about that was awesome. Awesome in that era. Beat Rip Morgan and Jack Victory, the Royal Family. But here's the best part. A newcomer named Glenn Gilberti in his fifth match showed a lot of potential and was reminiscent of Paul Roma in losing to Georgia champion Mike Servich. Now, they're talking about doing the first North Georgia television taping in the same building in 2 weeks, which they did. But of course, Glenn Gilberti, Bix, went on to become...
Disco Inferno.
That's right. That's right. He was working here first. But, yeah, Georgia All-Star, North Georgia Wrestling, criminally not enough of footage around. Criminally.
Well, apparently in Stephen Prazak's house there, it exist, so you need to.
Yes,
that.
And well, me and him's got to do the deal there and figure it out so I can transfer that to DVD, because God knows that stuff needs to be up there. Oh, this is great. Jimmy Snuka, who's not killing anybody, is said to be opening an indie in Salt Lake City, which never happened.
They said I can get married to more than one woman there, Murda.
Salt Lake City, brother. Lots of women there, brother.
Superfly Snuka loves the ladies.
Oh, man. Speaking of convicts, Blackjack Mulligan beat Mondo Clean to become the champion for Eddie Mansfield's IWF on February 28th in Orlando before 200 fans at the fairgrounds. Clean has now gone from the promotion, and Global's interested in Mondo Clean.
If I remember correctly, PWI or something actually did a story about this. That it was like
it was like
a press conference interview with Barry Windham or something, where he talks about getting a telegram from his dad to indicate how the match went, and the telegram was Mondo's clock was cleaned.
And Bix tell everybody who Mondo Clean would become.
That would be the one and only Damian Demento, who's not a jobber.
Trained by the great Johnny Rods. But yeah, PWI loved the Florida Indies at this time. They loved covering those groups. The ICWA and this group, and it's all the various Florida Indie groups. They were all over them.
They stopped eventually. There was no magazine love for guys like Siege Inaki or Mike Underfoot or
no.
I was going to try to figure out if he had a third gimmick.
Sage of the key. Once Jumbo Beretta retired, that was about it for the Florida groups.
Yeah, no Billy Fives.
A new startup group, well, this wasn't their first show, but one of their early shows, ran in Philadelphia on January 25th at the Original Sports Bar. JT Smith and DC Drake battled Larry Winters and Johnny Hotbody to a DDQ. Tony Stetson beat Ivan Koloff. That's right. Tony Stetson beat Ivan Koloff, and promoter Todd Gordon announced, that's right, that Kevin Sullivan, Eddie Gilbert, One Man Gang, and Jim Neidhart are coming in for future cards. This promotion, of course, was Eastern Championship Wrestling. Now, interesting names here, Bix, but Tony Stetson over Ivan Koloff?
Sure.
Now, they ran this Original Sports Bar for how long?
A while. It was their big venues were Original Sports Bar and I believe the Chestnut Cabaret.
Yes. Like into early 94. Then they run there?
Sports Bar.
I know November and
both.
Yeah. November 93 was in one of those places. I know that.
No, November to November 93 was at the arena.
Are you sure?
Yes.
It was one of those 93 big shows I remember that was in, because the lighting was completely different.
But I think that was still ECW Arena. It was November to November is the one with the weird, with the different lighting setup, but that is the arena.
Yeah. It's the beginning of a revolution, I guess you could say, wasn't it, Vix? Well, speaking of revolutions, you know, we had the Divas Revolution in 2015. Well, in 1992, we actually had an all-women's wrestling pay-per-view.
An attempt to do a very serious wrestling-oriented women's wrestling product.
Exactly. The LPWA, Ladies Pro Wrestling Association, headed up by Between the Sheets regular Tor Berg. And they ran a pay-per-view on February 23rd. Now, they haven't had a TV tape in about 9 or 10 months. And the show was in jeopardy.
Wait, did they still have TV, though? I forgot that part.
I guess they did. And the show was in jeopardy literally until the last minute. Now, they taped the pay-per-view at the Mayo Civic Center in Rochester, Minnesota, which was where the AWA taped television at the dying days, before 400 fans who were all let in free. Wow. Now, on television, they tried to explain the small crowd by saying there was an ice storm that day in Minnesota, which wasn't the case. So they lied about the weather. Given that there was little preparation involved and a few experienced women wrestlers participated, everyone involved should be pleased with the end result. Dave said it wasn't bad. It was even more entertaining than some pay-per-views that both WCW and WWF had run over the past year. The fans who were there provided a surprising amount of heat, considering the majority probably weren't familiar with any of the wrestlers, and even the promotion and announcers could possibly have been familiar about with half of those. Since nobody other than a few friends were promoted Tor Berg, and those who read last week's Observer had a clue as to what the lineup would be in the first place, the no-shows really couldn't disappoint anyone. But then again, how many people actually ordered? Surely the number of orders was well below what Herb Abrams' Beach Brawl did last June, which would make this the least ordered pay-per-view show in history. When you throw in travel costs for 8 wrestlers coming from Japan and 13 others flying from around the country, Denise Storm was the only local wrestler, plus Jim Cornette, Bonnie Blackstone, Joe Pedicino, and manager Boogaloo Brown. Remember him, Bix? Not to mention payoffs and just the inherent cost of running a pay-per-view, this had to be a major loser. It's sad because this show did make an important statement. Women wrestling can be an entertaining major show in this country, and those who were there live who went in with no knowledge of virtually all the competitors still enjoyed themselves. Whether the public will buy it is totally unproven. Berg brought in 8 wrestlers from the now defunct JWP group in Japan, all of which had been off for a month because their company had gone out of business. In addition, with the exception of Harley Saito, who wasn't at 100% because of a bum knee, who ended up the night as one of the biggest crowd favorites, and Shinobu Kendori, none of them were top-of-the-line talent. Both Devil Masami and Dynamite Kansai were originally scheduled. Both were originally scheduled to appear. Even with second-rate Japanese women talent, for the most part, the fans came to the wrestlers that they didn't know in the bouts were entertaining. Wendy Richter also missed the show because they couldn't find her in time, since this was all put together on the fly. And Magnificent Mimi largely missed the show because they didn't want her there.
Wait, what? So was she booked?
Yeah, I guess so.
So they booked her and then just told her not to... What? I'm trying to figure out how that works.
Where was Wendy Richter at? Oh, man.
Well, could you imagine Magnificent Mimi on this show?
Oh, God. During the show, they actually announced a follow-up pay-per-view show emanating from Tokyo for the summer. But Dave doubts that would ever take place. And also spent this show as a swan song for the WWA, which has been in dire financial straits for a long time. Another drawback is that a lot of the cable companies in Northeast pulled the plug on the show because it went overtime just as the main event was beginning. Oh, my God. Okay. I'm not going to do a full deal here. I'll go over them. I'll give you the matches.
Well, have you ever seen the show? Because I have not.
I have never seen this show. Although I do remember the television because I remember Boogaloo Brown. And was thinking at the time, he would have been good on the male scene as a manager.
I don't know if I've ever seen him. I mean, I know the name, though, from the stuff from the NWF.
He's kind of like
Women's Championship Wrestling stuff, because I know about the Prince cutting that promo on him. And calling
if I remember right, he was
Spider Monkey.
He was kind of like Reggie B. Fine.
Ooh.
He was that type of character. Yeah. Mickey Honda and Mommy Kitamura beat Lisa Starr and Allison Royal. Ring announcer Al DeRusha managed to botch up their names and introductions. What a shock. Denise Storm pinned Susan Green in the LPWA Japanese title tournament. Reggie Bennett beat Yukari Osawa, also in the tournament. Jim Cornette kept making jokes about Bennett's weight, comparing him to Man Mountain Mike and Haystacks Calhoun. Shinobu Kandori pinned Desiree Peterson. Fans chanted USA, USA, even though Peterson was announced for being from Denmark. And it's really from Canada. Holly Saito beat Mizuki Endo. Igo Sawai beat Midori Saito. Black Venus pinned Rockin' Robin, who, of course, was Sam Houston's sister, and who that was referred to, and Grizzly Smith's daughter, but not Jake Roberts' sister. And Robin bled in the ring, hard way juice.
Bleeded?
Bleed, yeah, bled. And in the ring from Harway. Then you had Storm over Bennett.
I'm assuming Dave that these are not all Japanese wrestlers because of the no-shows.
Yeah, Dave said that Bennett was originally supposed to win this tournament, but she didn't make the weight limit. Okay. Saito and Sawai went to a time limit draw. The crowd was tired at this point, Okay, Dave fucked this whole thing up. The crowd was tired at this point, but they worked hard, and the crowd ended up into it. Wally Carbo awarded the match to Saito a point. All right, here we go. Leilani Kai and Judy Martin, the famed Glamour Ghouls, kept their LPWA tag titles, beating Bambi, who I just saw wrestle last week, and Malia Hosaka. Of course, the Glamour Girls, not Glamour Ghouls. And then you had Saito over Storm to become the LPWA Japanese champion with that rolling crotch hold again. But your LPWA, yeah, your LPWA title was the main event as Terry Power, who you may remember as Tori from WWF, beat Lady X, Peggy Lee Leather. Of course, if Bambi's there, so it's Peggy Lee Leather. And, all right, Dave said the Power did, she did two interviews with baritone voice about the Power Positive thinking so much that they hopefully they're one of the sponsors of the show. LPWA is pretty well done in the United States with no future cards or tapings planned, but we'll still attempt to syndicate the old tapes in Canada.
Good luck with that.
Yes, good luck with that indeed.
Now, how is Bambi these days?
I tell you this. She can still do stuff. I mean, she's 49, I think is what she said she was. 48, 49 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Her hair looks exactly the same, except it's gray, it got gray in it.
So she's got she a kept gray the same hair. Fee mullet?
Yeah, she's still got the fee mullet. She had other women there written around that weren't Peggy Lee Leather. That looked like, I don't know if they were family members or stuff. I'm not going to make any allegations. But they were there for that match and then left after that match. So I thought that was interesting. And they basically built it as her retirement match. She worked Amber Gallows. And, you know, it was basically her retirement match at the end. She gave a speech and stuff. And before the match, she cut this long promo that went way too long. And I think you could tell that they were in the ring announcer, and Amber was like, trying to say, shut up, let's get started. But she wanted to talk, you know, and they let her go. And the match was okay. It wasn't that great. But, I mean, she's not 1989 Bambi, or I guess you could say.
Or 2001 Bambi.
Yeah, or 2001 Bambi.
Excuse she's me, got... four-time former World Women's Champion Selena Majors.
Yeah. That's what she dropped.
Is that her real name?
Yes.
That is her real name?
Selena definitely is a real name. And I think her last name is Majors. I could be wrong, but I do know her real name is Selena. But, yeah, I mean, she was... People don't forget about her. I mean, WCW used her on numerous occasions. She was a big deal at that time period.
I don't know.
Heavily pushed by Joe Pedicino.
Yes.
Oprah Wrestling this week.
Okay.
But she was.
Okay. I believe you.
Go back and watch that 88 Pro Wrestling this week stuff. You know, she was always around. So, well, she was local, too. Her first match was in Griffin, Georgia, for God's sakes.
How did Peggy not work with each other on this show, though?
Peggy Leather was old. That's how old she is now. Because she worked in... Yeah, remember, Peggy Leather was
working... I was thinking about the LPWA thing, but...
No, that show? Oh, yeah. But Peggy Leather now, I mean, she was working WWF shows in the 70s.
Well, she was a Moolah trainee, right?
Yeah. So, anyway. Well, we'll go to the World Wrestling Federation, where our first story definitely has nothing to do about women. As Phil Mushnick's column in the New York Post on February 26th had the headline, quote, WWF to face suit alleging child sex abuse, unquote. Mushnick wrote that, according to, quote, highly placed sources, unquote, a lawsuit will be filed next month in a New York City federal courthouse alleging that WWF male administrative employees and executives sexually harassed and abused underage teenage boys who were engaged as ring assistants in the latter half of the 1980s. Mushnick's sources also claimed that there would be charges that the WWF transported minors across state lines for the purpose of moral corruption as well as violating child labor laws. Mushnick said that the plaintiff's story had been corroborated by another party who claims to have been similarly abused while an underage teen WWF ring attendant. Other major media outlets are expected to be reporting on this story in the next few weeks, as well combined with the steroid scandal in the last 10 days. Here we go, Bix.
Yeah.
Let it begin.
Oh, you know, we should have had Mike Sawyer on, I think, because he knew one of them. He knew the one Chris Loss, the one that wasn't Tom Call.
Well, I think whenever we do, because it all really breaks down 2 days later.
Yes.
That whenever we do that one, we definitely need to have him on that show for sure.
But yeah,
because Patterson and Garvin resign on the 2nd of March.
Yeah, and Chris Loss, if I remember correctly, like disappeared like within a week or two of his name being attached to everything. Maybe a little more than that, but he disappeared fast. And Tom Cole had his complicated relationship with everyone over the years. You know, a while back, Irv got me he got the complaint from the Tom Cole lawsuit, and he sent me a PDF of it. Apparently, I don't know if this is the copy at the courthouse or there were some shenanigans going on, but it's illegible. It's completely like faded out. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm not saying anyone did it deliberately, but it's awfully strange. I mean, I know it's from 1992. Who knows what type of... if it was stored on some crappy microfilm or whatever. But, like, I have it right here now. I just opened it. It's not exactly easy to read. And I mean in terms of legibility.
Yeah, I mean, it's... WWF is about to be in some big-time shit. Big-time shit. And it's just, you know, the steroids just happened, and now this is coming. So, and this is when Vince is, you know, is this the start of the Vinceville Mushnick stuff? Or that, I'm trying to remember, that already started.
There might have been a little bit with the steroid stuff, but this is when it really gets going.
Yeah. Well, in other sad WWF news, they have been saying that Kerry Von Erich will be welcomed back upon completion of his rehab at the Billy Ford Clinic. Upon being taken off the road to enter rehab and a subsequent arrest before rehab. Now, Fritz Von Erich appeared on KDFW in Dallas this past week and claimed that Kerry was addicted only to painkillers and that he had been addicted to them for the past 6 years since a motorcycle accident. The drugs he allegedly falsified the prescription for on February 9th, which resulted in two felony counts wearing fat painkillers, Valium and Vicodin. On Thursday, the district attorney in Richland, Texas, decided to press charge in the case, which in a worst-case scenario would result in 10 years prison and a $5,000 fine. It's suspected upon completion of drug rehab, Von Erich will receive a suspended sentence. Chris Von Erich, when asked on television if Kerry's rehab is unsuccessful, should remain arrested and admitted that if it doesn't work, he should find a new possession. I mean, new profession, excuse me. Yeah, wow, it was 40 and slip. Should find a new profession. Now, on Wednesday, Tom Zink pled innocent on 6 counts of steroid possession, and Zink would have received 2 years probation and a $1,000 fine if he had pled guilty. A subsequent hearing will be scheduled in about a month. So Kerry wasn't really got in trouble, but you read this stuff, and to me, I'm thinking that it would have been good if Kerry had went to jail.
Because we saw how that ended up when he was actually going to go to jail.
Well, yeah, but this was a year earlier. You know, I don't know. I just think that Kerry needed to get away. I think if Kerry would have got away for an extended amount of time, that maybe he could have gotten better.
Hey, he did okay for a couple months coming out of rehab, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what, though? But it's not like he'd have ever been to rehab before with all the denial with everything with him and Fritz. You know what I mean? It's like, it was maybe just if he had gotten into rehab sooner, maybe he had, you know, not saying it would have taken it first, but maybe if he had a few more tries.
Yeah.
Then maybe things would have turned out differently.
And then you got Fritz lying for him again about the drugs. This terrible, 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 terrible stuff. More WWF problems. Demolition Axe, Bill Eadie, filed a suit against WWF, a man, for share profits because he claimed he came up with Demolition Persona. Among those Eadie's lawyer got depositions from were Earthquake, Big Boss Man, Jesse Ventura, Jake Roberts, Jim Duggan, Randy Savage, Typhoon, Kato, and IRS. How you can get a deposition from Kato? He can't talk. But
No, he's funny. Japanese. They got a translator.
You're right.
They got Mr. Fuji funny, to translate.
Yeah. All those guys are WWF employees except for one. Isn't that interesting?
Hmm. And
Ventura.
Yeah, and this lawsuit lasted into something like 2001.
Yeah. Which he won the case. Did he not?
Oh, I'm trying to remember exactly how it ended. I'm not sure.
Well, he's able to use his Demolition character.
That's right, but then when he started teaming with Darso on the indies, Darso wasn't able to be called Smash, at least at first.
Yeah.
What was that name he was using?
It wasn't Smasher, was it?
Oh, was it Smasher? I don't know.
I can't remember.
But it was weird, because they were able to be Demolition, and Eadie was able to be Axe, but Darso couldn't be Smash.
Yeah. Now, heading into WWF,
Randy Colley would have been able to be Smash, though.
He may have been. Now, speaking of demolition, heading into the WWF full time on the road are Brian Adams as Crush and Del Wilkes.
Well, guess not. Half right.
No, we're talking about that. We thought about the Patriot. I know we talked about the Hudson Brains Exile, but he would have been a quality addition to the WWF.
Definitely.
At this time period, yeah. As a babyface.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder what exactly happened there. Well, it's not like he doesn't follow me on Twitter. I should just ask.
Because, was this the time period where he just left wrestling altogether when he started having some problems?
No, that was 97. That was at the end. That was the end, 97.
I thought he had problems during his run. Because there were times where you never saw him listed anywhere.
When
but he may have some issues then.
When did he work South Atlantic, and then when did he start with All Japan?
All Japan would have been, I know he was there in 93.
Right.
And I just know there's gaps.
When was South Atlantic?
I can't remember.
There aren't really any gaps after he starts with All Japan, though.
No.
Although it does look like he went off chemical assistance, the other type of chemical assistance, went for a while in All Japan.
Yeah. He wasn't as jacked, that's for sure. February 23rd at Madison Square Garden drew 14,000 fans in a whopping $260,000 house. For this lineup, the Berserker pinned Jim Brunzel. Nasty Boys pinned the Bushwhackers. The Warlord pinned Conan Chris Walker in a -3-star match.
Good God. Wait, was this now I'm trying, was this the last show on MSG Network, or was that the month before? I feel like this aired.
I'm thinking it's this one.
I want to see Warlord versus Conan Chris Walker. I want to watch it with Rob Naylor and do commentary on it.
Now, what about this match? Sid Justice pinned Hercules in 20 seconds.
Okay, yeah, that is on tape. So this show is on tape, yes.
That's Hercules, I think, last match in the promotion.
Doesn't he no-sell the powerbomb and walk out?
Yes. Then you had Roddy Piper beating the Repo Man.
Well, who also, gotta love that happens to Sid, too.
Of all people. Undertaker pinned British Bulldog. Rick Martel pinned Big Boss Man. And Sid Justice wins a 21-man battle royal, which included Hogan and Flair. Last two were Justin Hogan. Ref was bumped. Hogan threw Justice over the top. Justice came back in, threw Hogan over the top. Well, threw him out of the middle rope. Ref got up, saw Hogan on the floor, and raised Justice's hand. Amazing.
That was bogus.
But yeah, this was, if not the last, one of the very final MSG cards that aired on MSG Network.
Was there ever a reason given for why they stopped when they did? Because I know they gave up. I know they gave up most of them because they realized they shouldn't have all these different house shows where guys are having the same matches. move for move, but they kept MSG for almost 3 years after they got rid of the other ones.
Yeah. I really don't know the answer. Really don't know. Although I miss those. I always loved the MSG shows.
Did you have a dish back then?
No, I would see it on the Coliseum Video and Primetime and stuff like that. I just loved the way everything, I mean, it was, you had the different type of announcing. I mean, it was just fun. And our last story of the evening, on February 29th episode of Superstars, Jake Roberts was a guest of the funeral parlor in which he attacked The Undertaker and locked his arm in a casket, repeatedly hit him with a steel chair, and hit DDT on Paul Bearer after Taker told Roberts he was no longer on his side. Moments later, Taker stalked Jake backstage with his arm still trapped inside the casket.
Dragging it behind him,
and we have that, folks. So get ready for this.
We're joining it in progress, right?
In progress. Join in progress.
That's what I need to know.
Well, why don't you just ask him yourself? Oh, yes.
Oh, all right. Now things are going to get very, very interesting.
Wait a minute. From behind. There he is right there. He's right behind Paul Bearer. There's The Undertaker.
Ooh. This video reversed on YouTube, or did they reverse the set?
I don't know.
You and I have a real problem. Now I'm standing here, and you need to tell me something face to face.
Listen to that very genuine crowd noise.
Who in the hell do you think you are, and whose side are you on? You tell me, whose side are you on?
By the way, if you ever wondered if Undertaker's height was a work, Jake is about as tall as him here.
I know. Jake was deceptively tall anyway.
Come on! Tell me whose side you're on! Face to face, come on! Make up your mind, man. You make it up.
Here it comes.
Not yours.
Listen to that crowd.
I love Jake smiling.
Is this what makes you tick? Is this what it's you need in life? Is this your cross that you have to have, brother? There it is, man. Let me tell you something, though, big boy. I owe you one. Don't turn your back on me. I owe you one.
Oh, wait a minute. No. Oh. Look what he did.
Oh, no.
His hand is caught at the end of that coffin. Oh, no, wait a minute. Jake the Snake sits the coffin and escaping the DDT.
Wow, McMahon. What is going on? Look at this. The Undertaker trying to get his hand out of the casket. It's sealed shut. It is tight. It can't be moved.
They've got to be smashing his fingers, McMahon, flat. They got to be smashing him flat.
And Paul Bearer is out. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, look at that. Jake the Snake hit the dude.
This is a big deal, this angle. It's high. Well, somebody did this Undertaker.
Limp now. His hand's still in the casket.
So now, as you can see.
Wait a minute, he's back up. He's back up on his feet. The Undertaker is standing tall.
Okay, you want to play for a little bit. I'll be mine, huh? I like to play too.
Listening to the canned heat on headphones is really unpleasant. Isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Jake Roberts has him for the chair.
Anyway, yeah, so I'll skip ahead. So then.
Like this, McMahon. He's dragging that casket's got to weigh a couple hundred pounds at least. Roberts is thinking about getting out of town. Look at this, moving back in. Look, nothing
can stop The Undertaker.
The Undertaker?
The Undertaker slowly but surely continuing to stalk Jake the Snake Roberts, dragging the casket in his left hand.
Oh, look at that. That's it. Take a knee out.
Boy, between the canned heat and Mr. Perfect on color, that's not the most pleasant segment to listen to.
Yeah, Mr. Perfect replaced two people. He played Savage and Piper. Yeah, that was that was the beginning of Undertaker as a babyface.
Yeah, for a wrestler who did a lot of for a wrestler who is not good at color commentary, I should say, Kurt Hennig did way too much of it.
He did a lot, yeah. It's weird that he wasn't good, I thought. Yeah, because he was a good promo.
Yeah, well, Superstar Billy Graham.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good call there, too. Yeah, I'm sure we probably think of other ones, too, if we went down.
Honestly, all of the angles Undertaker was in around that time were really good.
Yes.
Like, a lot of good and memorable angles. They used to be all in that type of thing, and they booked him very well. I mean, the stuff with Jake turned on Warrior is a little wacky, but still, I mean, everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. And, well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's it for now. I mean, and Jake, of course, you know, was... Jake was tremendous as a heel during this whole period, too, and unfortunately, well, you know the story.
Yeah. Poor Jake. Anyway, that's it this evening. Bix, what do you have to plug?
I don't know.
You don't know? Yeah, you know.
No,
you're always doing something.
Well, follow me on Twitter at David Bix. This week on 605 Super Podcast, very special episode. What we did was we had kind of a normal length show talking about various things, including... Yeah, you know, Kerry Von Erich and Eddie Gilbert with the anniversary of their passings and some other stuff. And then, courtesy of Brian, we include, after most of the show, the audio from the first annual Eddie Gilbert Memorial Show's like brunch banquet thing with the speeches from Jerry Lawler, Doug Gilbert, Debbie Combs, Jim Cornette, Mick Foley, against the wishes of Paul Heyman. And others. I mean, it's really cool. As far as Brian knows, I've never really been, you know, released anywhere publicly before, so that's on the show this week. So check that out at 605pod.com. That's 605pod.com. And, you know, for all my other stuff, you know, just keep up on Twitter and all that. And I don't want to bore everyone with too much. So, yeah, there you go.
Awesome, awesome. And that was the show that we talked about on Between the Sheets with the Doug Gilbert promo.
Yes. Actually, you know what? I do have one other thing to push, actually, which is that I was also on Jordan Breen's Press Row podcast this week on Sure Dog, talking about freak show MMA fights and stuff like that. And
the best kind of MMA fight.
Yes. And I even got in a reference to our buddy Kurt Brown, Vandal Drummond. Because yeah. I tried to stump Jordan in talking about a game, Great American Mat Endeavors. Dan Severn got brought into the UFC off of a match there he had with Al Snow trying to do a shoot style pro wrestling match with Al Snow in game, which was like a mixed shoot and shoot style promotion that ran California and other places. And I think Kurt Brown had some kind of legit. I forget if it was a legit shoot match. And they had a tournament that was won by Superboy without his mask.
Sounds like a hell of a show.
Yeah, had you ever heard of Game?
Yeah, I remember that. Yep, I do remember reading about that.
What's his name? Didn't Shirley Dose and Panico also have a match in Game on one of their shows?
I think so, yes.
Actually, yes, am I confusing? Wait, Kurt did too, right? I'm not confusing them, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Kurt did
California. Sounds right.
Yes.
All right. Let's see. Between the Sheets every Monday. You know that. Next week, we'll be doing 1986. So we're going to go back to the 80s. for the first time in a while. And very rarely we do these shows, but some big things going on that week, including the return of Jerry Lawler to Memphis. So they'll be talking about that. Get ready for a lot of audio on that show, folks. Now, Exile on Bad Street. Taped the show with Bo James. That should be dropping soon, right, Bix?
Yes, soon.
Hopefully within the next day or so after you hear this show. So go check that out. When we talk about the very first year proper Continental Championship Wrestling from June 85 to June 86. And lots of good stuff on there. Lots of good stories from Bo. Some stuff I never heard of before. And just really good stuff. And Carl Stern was supposed to be on with us, but Alabama got hit by some bad tornadoes that when we recorded, so he had to go into work because, of course, he is a officer, so he had to handle that duty. But we'll have him on when we do our next show because, of course, it's going to be a series of shows. So, yeah, check that out when it comes out. Great show. Of course, listen to all the other shows that we've done on PlaceToBeNation.com. Finding Spirit Magazine, go check out the latest issue. I have a article in there about La Sombra or Manny Andrade and what people should expect from him in the WWE. And what's funny about him right now is that people that go to NXT shows, they pretty much always say that he has the best match on the shows now in Florida, the Florida shows, which is funny. So,
and that article features photography by... Or actually, wait, did you not know this? Have you not seen it yet? Because I... Black Terry Jr.?
Yes, Black Terry Jr., that's correct. I heard about it, but I didn't know if it was true or not. Yep. There you go. There you go. The great Black Terry Jr., a true gem. Talking Sheet midweek. I guess I'm pretty much on there every week now as a regular. So check that out every Thursday when it drops. The last show was a really fun show. With Jeff Hawkins for Shake Them Ropes, Hugh Little, Cecilia was there for a segment, of course, Les. So they're giving us a lot of stuff to talk about. I'm sure this week we'll have more stuff to talk about after Raw with Undertaker making his return. So check that out. Other than that, I think that's going to hit it all off. I guess, of course, I'm on Twitter at KRISZELNER. So go there and check me out there. Of course, one more time, if you do shop on Amazon.com, tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon. I use it every time I shop there, so you should too. All right. We are going to close this bitch out. Bix, thank you. So we're going to close this bitch out. So thank you, Bix, for being here every week and providing all the great audio and all the great things you do. And I am Chris, saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.